If you don't like what we tell you to believe in, we'll kill you.
TheRightStuff.biz.
Cool. I'll sit here and do literally nothing. It's gonna be great.
living the dream.
Yeah. So I'm just gonna plug my phone back in here in case I lose power as well. Yeah. So Sven, you know, we were about to record prep and he just blinked out. You just, like, boom, gone, and then, you know, power out and done. So we're having some pretty bad wind around here. I know it's been up and down the East Coast. And,
that's not actually what happened to Sven.
I think Russell still announced this is TDS episode 580.
Oh, yes. Thank you, sir. Thank you. See, these are the kinds of things I forget to do. Thank you. So I'm here with Alex and Borzoi. Sven is not here today. We have no idea when his power will be back on. Hopefully by Wednesday. I might lose power, but I'm looking out my windows and, you know, I'm seeing trees swaying. Where I am, actually, interestingly, was more vulnerable to this until, because it happened so many times in the last few years that they have seemingly taken steps to make it less likely to happen, like cutting down a lot of trees right around the power lines. So I'm reinforcing the power, putting up new power poles, you know.
What do I? Sven is locked in a cabin with Wilford Brimley.
Yes, yes.
He's feeling much better now and he wants to come inside.
He actually sent me a picture. I can't show it here, of course. He sent me a picture of his yard and his shed. It's not looking good. But, and he said his grill flew across his deck this morning. I've got chairs out on a balcony. Whatever. What are they going to do? I guess that day they actually could cause damage, but I think they're okay. So yeah. Anyway, I'm here with Alex and Borzoi. This is TDS 580, and I don't know. We'll talk about stuff. It is day. I don't know what day it is of quarantine.
Oh, but yeah. Lost track of that. Yeah.
Well, I have no idea, but we're gonna start the show off with a debate. Here's point counterpoint on Anne Frank or Helen Keller, which is faker? Go, Alex.
I'm gonna actually go with Helen Keller on this one.
I got to agree.
Go with Helen Keller.
Got to agree because this is gonna cause some consternation. I know I'm known as a big Holocaust guy. Well, first of all, Borzo, you want to weigh in on that? Anne Frank, Helen Keller?
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you for a fact that Helen Keller is even faker because the Helen Keller archive was lost in the World Trade Center attack.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, okay, this whole thing was faked. I don't even, did she even ever exist? There's no glass eyes, no evidence. No.
The whole purpose of 9/11 was to cover those tracks.
Yeah, they were, the Helen Keller story was coming unglued and they had to do 9/11 in a panic to get it back together. But in seriousness, I'm just saying
over the weekend, man, it's been an avalanche of stuff about Helen Keller. Just like my inbox is full of like the red pills on this. It's nuts.
Well, I don't know why it came, but Mitch Hoops started talking about it. And then another friend of ours who's like convinced of it. And I never really thought of it. I haven't thought of Helen Keller. So then I went back and I looked. I'm like, yeah, this obviously can't be true. So now just to start off, Anne Frank, you know, a lot of people always... The joke is you confuse the two, and how can I possibly... Which like, little girl crying story should I be more insensitive about to be a bad guy or whatever? But Anne Frank's story is actually believable, and my theory is I don't actually think that her diary is forged. I know a lot of people think the diary is forged. I think what happened is just heavily edited, because apparently they edited out stuff where she talked about like masturbation and sex and things like that, because she was, I guess, going through puberty at the time. Oh, so they, God, like, cleaned it up but there is stuff like that. And ballpoint pens, you know, I can't weigh in. I can't know for sure when ballpoint pens were introduced into Amsterdam or whatever or not. But in any case, Anne Frank died in 1945 of typhus at Bergen-Belsen. That's not a lie. And this diary that she wrote, you know, girls that are 12 years old write diaries. So this is a plausible story to me. Versus Helen Keller, where I do not believe that somebody that is dumb, deaf, and blind could interact with the world in any intelligible fashion. I believe Helen Keller was functionally retarded her whole life and was used as a prop by Annie Sullivan, amongst others, I guess, ultimately, because Annie Sullivan died and Helen Keller lived like another 30 years after that. But she wrote 12 books. And inside those books, if you read some of the texts, there's like visual and spatial metaphors and stuff. And then like conceptual, like higher concept. And I'm like, how can you teach somebody that is dumb, deaf, and blind through interacting with them by means of sensation and shapes, higher order concepts?
Well, she apparently, because she allegedly became a socialist and supported joined the IWW, the Wobblies,
yeah,
and she cited the 1912 strike for textile workers.
Yeah, I'm sure that's something that you were able, that was, you know, through purely shapes and sensations, she was able to be like communicated.
She's a prop for elitist shit libs that were just glomming on to whatever the fad was in that time period.
Yes, that's like that. No, well, I mean, it's not even just that. It's specifically Annie Sullivan. Now, Annie Sullivan was also blind, but blind people, because they can hear, and I don't know if she was blind her whole life, blind people can easily establish themselves as, you can easily understand higher order concepts and can learn through, you know, listening, and they can learn Braille, so they can read and things like that. So this is not something, but once you lose more than one sense, then it's like, okay, now you're just a stump. It's unfortunate, but it's true. And it's sort of like, you know, also think how these people think. They're very, you know, they're not the best people. However, they don't think they would abuse Helen Keller herself. They don't consider it abuse, because she's probably being treated quite well. She's being fed and made comfortable and things like that. But they don't have any remorse in lying to the public about her, like telling the public, oh, yeah. And also, you know, has this treatment, this wonderful treatment that Annie Sullivan used to teach Helen Keller how to think and write, has ever been successful on anyone else with this disorder? Like, I don't think so. I've never heard of that. So
real quick, what exactly is the tragedy with Anne Frank here? I mean, this is basically somebody that spent time in a concentration camp and was unsuccessfully treated for typhus, probably by Mengele, who took care of her father.
Well, no, it wouldn't have been, because she was at Bergen-Belsen, and Mengele was, that's not where he was stationed. He took care of her father?
From to Bergen-Belsen, so she was in Auschwitz at one point.
Oh, okay, all right.
Maybe he transferred her.
Maybe
out.
Maybe that's why she died. I mean, maybe she should have stayed in Auschwitz, and she could have survived. Because everybody survived Auschwitz. It seems there's like 4 million of them.
They had a great doctor.
Yeah, they have the best doctor. You know, it's true. Like again, you know, what's amazing is how much actual. The amazing thing about Auschwitz is what. And again, I could spurg on this all day. What a fucking sham it is. Like, and I used to just sort of know this, but I've ordered, as everyone knows, I ordered a bunch of books, and I've been reading them, and these are, like, big, thick, detailed volumes that have all the documents that were preserved. You know, they had so many documents that were preserved from Auschwitz, and then the Soviet Union, like, hid these, and then they became available in the early 90s, and I think it caused some kind of a panic, and they wanted to make sure nobody could see them, but a lot of people had already seen them, and, like, dude, there was no gas chambers. They were not massacring people again. There was a lot of people that died of typhus, but that was all documented. They performed 11,000 surgeries. Why would you do that to people you're going to gas?
Yeah, Otto Frank was at Auschwitz. That's her father, and yeah, he was treated by Mengele. It doesn't mention it in the Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, and he survived, true, right? He lived.
Yeah. He's
he
fine.
Lived, he lived to publish. I mean, he's probably dead now, but he lived to publish her diary later on. Maybe he's not. I mean, all these, who knows? These people live forever. So, anyway.
So, on Helen Keller, the National Socialists did burn her books, and she did write a letter to Adolf Hitler.
What?
Adolf Hitler, Berlin, Germany. History has taught you nothing if you think you can kill ideas. Tyrants have tried to do that often before, and the ideas have risen up in their might and destroyed them. You can burn my books, and the books of the best minds in Europe, but the ideas in them have seeped through a million channels and will continue to quicken other minds.
That's not a Batman. Just quoting Batman.
I gave all the royalties of my books to the soldiers blinded in the World War with no thought in my heart but love and compassion. Do not imagine your barbarity to the Jews are unknown here. He will visit judgment upon you.
Yeah, like, I'm sure that through shapes and, like, sensations of hot and cold or, like, water, you know, like pouring water over her hands or holding blocks, she was able to form, like, the higher order concepts to be able to write something and understand something like that. I'm sure that wasn't just written by, like, somebody. Like, she was a ventriloquist dummy, is what somebody was saying. Anyway, Sven has some audio. This is 3 minutes of laughs, he says. It might be totally off topic what we were talking about, but I'll play it anyway.
Oh, God. So, it's like, of all the years to buy a fucking snowblower, I got no power. I knew this was going to happen. I got no power. The power stops as soon as we're about to do record prep. My shed in the backyard has stood for like 13 years. 13 years that shed has stood there, gone through I don't know how many hurricanes, at least like 3, in Superstorm Sandy, which was fake, right? The Sandy, I think that's what Johnny
Sandy
said. The
revisionism.
Hurricane Sandy didn't happen. There were zero deaths, and it was all a lie. Freaking thing. And now, like, this morning, random, like, 30 mile an hour wind gust, my shed is leaning against my fence, just, like, up at an angle. And finally, my snowblower, which cannot be converted into a generator, I was using the weight of the thing to, like, hold down the base of the shed, because what happened was the shed just got blown off, just got pulled loose of the foundation screws or whatever. And so now the snowblower was holding down the base framing of the fucking shed, and now it's just like the wind blew so hard that it just ripped the base framing off of the vertical parts of the vertical framing and siding of the shed. So now it's just up in the air. My shed is broken, my snowblower is holding down, you know, the piece of the base framing, that's it, and all the things I don't like looking at, I can see. Basically, it's all, like, pool chemical supplies and cleaning things, stuff that I don't need, but, like, you know, like, where do I go get a truck to take the things that I don't want anymore to the dump that I don't want to be at, because, I mean, are there sick people working at the dump? Like, how does this work? Do I have my father? Would I have my father fucking come up here and bring his truck and we fill it? No, because why? Because my dad just, like, kept playing golf. I'm sure he's not sick, but it's like, like, what do we do here? I'm just so mad. And it's like, what makes me the most mad is, like, I can't even do anything that's, like, no, here's my Protestant future Hitler work ethic coming in. Like, I can't even do other tasks for the rightstuff.biz right now, because everything that I could possibly do, other than sitting quietly and writing lyrics into a notepad, like a fag, like everything that I could possibly do requires electricity. I don't know, I guess maybe I'll sit in the corner and maybe I'll read something, I don't know. I don't think I can read anymore. It's like Twitter. Like, I can only read, like, 140 characters or 280 characters at a time now. Like, a neat meme. This wind is awful. There's stuff blowing all over the place. I can't believe I don't have a generator. I can't believe Kurt Doolittle took out the power grid. He won't fucking wall off Manhattan. He lets those super spreaders just, like, run around the nation. But he cuts off my power. God damn it, Kurt. I thought you were one of us.
All right. Yeah.
Anybody having their feet hurt in their own home?
Wait, his feet hurt
Oh, because that means, like, what, you know, like, we're, like, listing off all the things you don't want to be doing or why you don't want to be there. Just, that's what sounds like it's on my speed.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, you better, it's, I mean, it's a gray day, but there's enough light to read by if you, you know, if you quick open and crack a book, but it's going to be all, like, pitch black.
I think it's Kurt Russell from The Thing. He's already, like, recording audio diaries and posting them. He's in isolation. It's terrible.
So I found something else on Helen Keller here. The plot thickens.
Okay.
So throughout the late 1930s, Keller continued to pay close attention to the growing European conflict, especially Hitler's rise to power. In this 1938 letter, she lobbied the now emeritus New York Times editor, good friend, and Westport neighbor John Finley to devote the resources of the Times to publicizing the devastating situation of Jews in Nazi-occupied territory. She asked him to highlight people with disabilities who were targeted by the Nazis as defectives and then denied entry into the United States and other nations because restrictive immigration laws likewise labeled them as defectives. European Jews, clients, and administrators of institutions for people with disabilities desperately sought help. The letters they sent me, and oh, I received so many, including one from a deafblind poetess, are full of pathetic faith in American goodwill and counsel. Now here's the kicker right here. Tragically, the 1946 fire at Keller's home in Arcan Ridge destroyed those letters.
Oh, unfortunately. But I'm also saying this is sort of funny because, so this is what's funny is that, you know, and this is the other thing that is always pointed out by the people that that write, you know, a lot of these revisionist historians and things who are actually very good historians. This is my thing, like, from my perspective, as I read some of these books that are revising the narrative, they're not just revising it's not just like, oh, here it was all fake. It's like they go through documents in a very detailed way, and they give you their best hypothesis and things like that of what was going on. And I'm like, these people seem to be much more scientific historians than like the other side, and they always give you what the other side says, and, you know, which is mainly propaganda, frankly. It's mostly like over-emotional propaganda. But besides that, it's sort of like, you know, one of the things I always point out is, like, so as you read, so the Germany was supposedly so terrible to disabled people. That's not actually true, but they were sterilizing them, and they were euthanizing some people. That doesn't mean they were euthanizing somebody that was, like, in the full of their life. Like, if you were retarded and, like, 30 years old, they weren't you. But if you were older and sick or something like that, they would euthanize. That was a policy. This is so barbaric. Yet every other country had the same thing. Like, you can't be the U.S. and get on your moral high horse when you don't want to take these people, right?
Well, because they're doing that right now.
The famous case of Buck v. Bell, where Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. ruled against the people who didn't want to be sterilized and said three generations of imbeciles are enough.
Right. So, yeah, and on top of that,
they're doing that literally right now. They're doing that with coronavirus. They're just loading up patients that have no hope with morphine and letting them die.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has to do this at some point, and the Germans decided to do it, and they decided to do it. Of course, what people don't like is they use this term, the English translation was the term racial hygiene. People don't like that. It sounds really bad, but it's like, well, you know, you can be mad at the term, but the United States also had racial laws. The United States had racial immigration laws. The United States didn't want to, you couldn't immigrate if you were retarded. They weren't letting, like, retards in, or fags. They didn't want homosexuals in either. And it's really funny because they, you know, guys, like, there's, like, no evidence of fags. Like, they added fags to the Holocaust, like, just because. Like, there's no evidence that people were put into camps just for being, like, just for being fags. It was people who were who had engaged in public sodomy or had, like, raped kids and things like that that were put into these places.
So that was what the pink triangle was for?
They were like sex criminals. Basically, like, literally, they were like rapists and child molesters, and, like, everyone's supposed to cry for them. So, and then meanwhile, like, homosexuality, it wasn't illegal in America at the national level. At certain states it was, not at the national level, but it was illegal in Great Britain at the same time. So again, they always would be like, so these supposedly barbaric laws of the National Socialist regime, you know, Britain and the United States had most of them too, because this was just people's attitudes back then. So you can be shocked. There was a time when people approved of eugenics, when people thought it was fine to sterilize retards, and people thought it was fine to outlaw, you know, gay sex. You can be mad, but remember, the United States and England did that too. And the United States had racial laws too. So don't get up on so high on your high horse about this. In fact, the United States racial laws are probably more cruel because we have more blacks. Like, you know, Germany didn't even have... They didn't even have many racial minorities. They had Jews and probably some others, but, you know, a few others. But Hitler was also very much against... reading this book called Hitler's Revolution right now, which is... It's a good book if you want to get an understanding of a look at the Third Reich that's not propagandized. It's not anti-propaganda. It's definitely a little bit, very much, in, you know... let's say it's giving a very nice picture of what the Third Reich was like. But again, it's sort of like, well, why shouldn't I read something like that to balance out, like, all just, like, the idea that this place is hell on Earth? Like, it doesn't make sense that it would be hell on Earth. And, you know, also, Hitler's economic policy definitely worked. Like, this much they can't deny, and I've always wanted to know what it was specifically, and this guy outlines it. It's a good book. What's this?
Yeah, they used to not even lie about that when I was in school. Like, we tried to find ways to do, like, a well, actually, about the German economy wherever they could, but they had a lot of trouble arguing against the success of it, which is why they always, when I was growing up, they always had to pivot to, well, this is why you wouldn't want to live under National Socialist Germany.
Right. Well, the thing is that as I read about it, you know, I see that a lot of what they want, and this is where the liberals are the real Nazis and stuff comes in from conservatives, conservatives who are really consistent liberals. I'm like, you know, a lot of these policies are exactly what so many people in this country have wanted. And they're combined, though, with policies that can... It's literally exactly what... It's literally like the others... It's literally the opposite of the kosher sandwich. It's like... It's the comfy economic stuff that liberals want and the comfy social stuff that conservatives want. It's like... He's like, everyone get back to the family, like women back to the home, men back to the fields, back to the factories... And we'll pay you to do this, and like we're gonna make a lot of money available for huge public works, and make money available to make all the buildings look nice. We'll build houses for the workers out that are out somewhat in nature, so they can enjoy nature. And it's like, and this all worked, like all these things worked, and it's like, imagine that system versus what we have now, and then the kosher dialectic we have. That's the thing, Germany didn't have a kosher dialectic because there was no dialectic, because Hitler was Führer. And that was a policy, and that sounds so awful to people that are raised in, you know, Western democracies, but think about it for a second. It's not like a monarchy either, because he's like, it's like a, you know, there is a state and a state apparatus, and he's just the guy that ultimately he gets to make decisions. Like, think how much you wanted when Trump was first elected for him to just blow away all the red tape and get shit done. That's what Hitler did. Like, everyone wanted Trump to just be a fucking dictator. Just hey, blow through Congress, build the fucking wall, deport the immigrants. You know, yeah, go ahead, Alex.
I was just getting lost in the weeds over here looking at the Frank family. So when they died of typhus, which was common in these camps, contagions like typhus, because, I mean, you got Orthodox Jews who were full of typhus, I guess, but they would bury the bodies in mass graves. Why didn't they incinerate those bodies? Why didn't they burn them?
They did that when they didn't have enough cremation capacity, so they had to get rid of them because they were contagious.
It happened in Germany, and in German crematories just were not as good as the ones they built in Poland. It's just that, something about that Polish ground just is very fertile for crematoriums.
Well, okay, now, I don't know, I'll tell you this, I know a lot about the layout of the Auschwitz camp. I don't know as much about the other camps, so I can't say, but Auschwitz did have quite a lot of ovens, I will say this. So there's two Auschwitz camps, there's Auschwitz 1 and Auschwitz 2, which is also called Birkenau. So these furnaces, crematorium furnaces, would be like one furnace attached to several muffles. Now, a muffle is just the box that you put the body into, and it's got, you know, so in Auschwitz 1, there are three furnaces with six muffles right next in that gas chamber that they have, because Birkenau is destroyed. They destroyed it, so it's not there anymore. But Auschwitz 1 is where you go if you go to Poland to see Auschwitz. And the what they call the crematorium one, which is the gas chamber you see, the room that they say is a gas chamber obviously was not ever a fucking gas chamber, and there's a ton of reasons that just it could never have been. It was a morgue. It was a place where it was a cool room where they stored dead bodies. And the main giveaway is, of course, the swinging wooden door, which is, people make the joke about wooden door, but this is true. It's not a gas-type door. It's a swinging, and it swings to both sides, and they do that so you're dragging a body because you're going to take it to be cremated. So it's really, you know, macabre to think about this, but, you know, it's like they're telling us a lie, so you have to, like, get up the stomach to talk about this shit. It was a fucking morgue. And it's obvious that it was a morgue. There was a toilet in there. Why would they have a bathroom in a gas chamber?
Like, you'll find me hanging from the bathroom.
Yeah, you'll find me gassed in a bathroom. Like, it doesn't make sense. But in the other camp, they actually had 46 muffles. They had, like, what was it? I don't know the number of furnaces, but 46 muffles. But again, then when you look at this all gets very technical. You look at the days at the time when they were built and the time that they spent in operation. This guy was going through. He's like, all right, so they built these at this time, and then those weren't enough because they were having a period where like 8,000 people died in 1 week from typhus.
And so this is like the winter, right?
Yeah, so this is like really bad in 1943, 1944. And so these crematoriums they brought online to kind of handle this, and they were not all operating at the same time. So the idea is, like, if you operated those at peak efficiency for 5 years straight, but they didn't even operate for 1 year straight. Like, it was 1943-44 is when they were the only time they existed. And then, you know, they weren't in operation all the time, and they weren't on operation at the same time all the time. So and this guy goes through, it's very detailed, like, and they know this, and all this is documented. So his thing is, like, if they were working, this guy Carlo Montagno, who's an Italian researcher in this, and this is a more detailed estimate than I've ever heard anybody that believes a Holocaust give. People that believe in it have never given me any of this information, so I can only the only choice I have is to believe the guy who does give me the information. Which is, he's saying, like, if you base the average time, and I mean, I know this is old stuff for people, but I'm telling you what it actually is. He was saying somewhere between like 90 to 110,000 bodies could, in that time period that these things were all online, could have been cremated. And it's not realistic to think that that they did any more than that. And that seems about right, because they actually, another thing that the Soviet Union hid was something called death books, which were ledgers, 1,500-page ledgers, on which each page was a name and a description of a time and reason of death of somebody at Auschwitz.
God, the Nazis made Death Note real.
So, yes, they did. And they had 46 of these death ledgers that the Soviet Union had recovered, and they hid them because it goes totally against the Holocaust narrative. And so,
Cause it's like dry postmortems on people dying of typhus.
Yeah.
Things like that.
And why would they do that if they were gassing people at the same time? Well, to cover it up. Okay, get the fuck out of here. Just shut the fuck up. Like, what? This is all, honestly, it's resistance propaganda. This was like Jewish-Polish resistance, and it was like atrocity propaganda. All the Holocaust is atrocity propaganda. Saddam Hussein is throwing babies into ovens, like the baby incubators, like the Iraqi army marches through Kuwait, and they throw the babies into furnaces and shit. It's that kind of shit all over again. Like, World War One, they're throwing babies up in the air, and the Germans are spiking them on bayonets and shit. Like, none of it's true. Like, this is just atrocity propaganda, and they just made it real after the war by, you know, basically saying it's illegal to say that our atrocity propaganda wasn't true. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, isn't the claim that they burned, like, what, at least 5 million bodies, something like that?
Well, the claim is that, no, it always, this is the other thing, the story changes. The story constantly changes. So now they're saying 1.1 million gassed and burned with no trace at Auschwitz. there was a mass grave at Auschwitz that had 500 bodies in it. So given that they had that, and they, though, none of those people died from Zyklon B poisoning. They all died from typhus. So given that, they had to bury 500 because they couldn't cremate them. That should tell you something. They didn't have the efficiency
to burn millions of bodies, and you have a typhus outbreak, and you're just burying them. Like, that doesn't add up.
Look, they're burying them not in Central Park, in some other island in New York. There's an island, Howard's Island, I think it is. There's a bunch of little islands around. They're tiny ones, and I think they went to one of them, and one of them has actually only been a cemetery. Anyway, I think they're out there right now, and that's where those pictures have come, where you've seen them putting those caskets, those wooden caskets, into the ground. So, again, you know, this is what governments do, this is what people do, and apparently, in this case, the city is like tagging these caskets, and they're gonna have a reference so you can look up, so later on, once things have cleared up, people can claim their relatives' remains and then do what they want with them, bring them to the final resting place they want, or have them cremated or whatever. But right now they just need to get them, these are a health hazard to have these dead bodies, and the morgues are all full, the funeral homes are full. And the refrigerated trucks, they brought in like 45 refrigerated trucks into New York City. They can handle 100 bodies each. And those all are all full. So this is the next step.
So probably what's happening here is you've got a lot of blacks, and they're never going to claim those bodies. Those bodies are just going to stay there.
They'll just be buried there then, yeah. They'll just be buried there. So that's that. Yeah, blacks aren't going to go back and claim those bodies.
I guess James is reading some sort of book that gives us like the real story about how the Holocaust killed 12 million people or something like that.
Dude, well, that's the other thing. Yeah, I mean, I can look up those screenshots he sent where it's just absurd. It's like, you know, they claimed the 5 million, and at one point it was a claim that was like 1 million Jews and 3 million Poles, resistance fighters, and Russians or other Gentiles gassed at Auschwitz. And they're like, oh yeah, that 3 million, we lied about that, but the Jews were real.
Right.
It's like, get the fuck out of here.
It's like 12 million, best I can do is 6.
No, I mean, everyone gets this, and people get mad. They're like, oh Mike, you know, these memes, you've been saying this again and again, and I'm like, well look, you read what I've read, and then you tell me you believe it. And I don't believe that any of these people that want to promote this have actually read this stuff. Because once you do, it's like, these guys make a very good case. And remember Molbug's thing? Like, he said Germar Rudolph, who's one of the revisionist historians, he's like, this guy's case is too detailed. It makes me suspicious. And it's like, dude, are you fucking kidding me? And he said the same thing about Kevin MacDonald. He said, anybody whose case is too detailed, oftentimes he's like, anyone who has like, and it's sort of a funny thing, because this is why he said why I don't believe Kevin MacDonald. He's like, yes, Kevin MacDonald has a lot of supposed evidence to back up his theory, but that makes me suspicious of it, because it's sort of like he requires that you assemble something in equal or greater detail to refute him, and I just don't have time for that. And it's like, that is like literally the worst.
That's how argumentation works. If you can't defeat his argument, then I'm sorry.
Well, it's like, is it important to you to for this not to be true? And it's like, that's also what scholars do. You don't have to do it, Moldbug. But if Germán Rudolph and Carlo Montano are wrong, then let one of the people because there are professional Jewish Holocaust historians, let one of them assemble a work of equal or greater detail refuting them, and they can't, and they can't, and they never have, and that's why they don't ever refute these guys. They just ignore them, because it's like, they're not gonna have this debate. They're like, we have the media, we have the bully pulpit, we have every Western government under our thumb, and so we don't need to talk about this shit. Like, we don't need to let you autistic historians that went through every Auschwitz document and wrote like a 1,300-page treatise. We don't have to let you into our little club. It's just going to ruin it. Like, billions of dollars are riding on this. And a whole state. The existence of a state and billions of dollars extracted from Germany are riding on this bullshit. So fuck you. Like, no, I'm not you're not going to let like one Italian and one German like ruin all that. Like, fuck that. Yeah. So that's really what it's about. And I just love that. It's like, oh, you want me to also have to write a book for you to be wrong. Fuck you.
Yeah, you're supposed to go along with the elite consensus here. Like, this is consensus. Why are you going against the consensus?
Yeah, I mean, that's Mulbug essentially says that. He's like, he does that. He does elite consensus is right, except for he wants it to be wrong. But it's like, again, he doesn't ever do any careful scholarship. He shows you, oh, I read a poem that you haven't read before, and there's a quote, and I'm going to pretend like you're supposed to know what it is, even though you don't.
Yeah. Well, his whole pitch is basically like, well, put people like us in power, and I'll let, you know, in his pitch to the reactionaries as well, you know, if we're in power, I'll let you guys be the middle managers for the rebel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, hey, wouldn't you want, like, computer programmers and tech CEOs shouldn't, because we're so good at management. That's the other thing. This is what annoyed me about that appearance he made. What was that show he did?
It was the Justin Murphy. I don't know. It was
right.
I know what show, the recent one he did where he said, yeah, like, let me debate Nazis. And, like, it was something with Justin Murphy. He was
Some kind of Q&A. I don't know who that, who is Justin Murphy? I never heard
of him. He's like before. Some leftist journalist that's been kind of like, I guess he converted to Catholicism or something. He's been kind of like, he's like a, I guess like a Bernie bro type guy.
That's who's like been playing Turbo
footsie, been playing footsie with like Dark Enlightenment stuff.
Yeah. So he was talking about Mulbug was like delivering red pills and stuff, and I'm like, all right, like, sure thing, guy.
Why would you think that if you're good at managing a tech company that you would be suited to manage anything else? Like,
why should I think that a specialized domain?
Wonderful.
Why should I think that tech people are good at managing? Like, I've worked for tech companies. Like, they're not even that good. Like, managers at tech companies are usually women. And what is it? Like, okay, it's always like, okay, what's the project? All right, let's figure out how to do the project. And then the project manager comes in, and then they have, like, all these software tools and shit, and they want you to conform your workflow to, like, their software tools and, like, the workflows that they have been trained to do. And it's like, there's nothing special about this. It's like, literally just a cookie-cutter management style that they have been taught. And it's like basically just a way of delegating tasks and then breaking balls until somebody finishes their part of it, and then everyone has a meet, and there's way too many meetings, I'll tell you that much. There's way too many fucking gay meetings involved in this shit. And workers, actual tech workers, have complained about it for years because they're like, this shit is fucking gay. They're like, Scrum.
Well, you know what argument they also make about why, like, you know, with women and this stuff, like, is like about HR, and like they argue that it's because of the government that they're even there. Like, if the government, like, this is where you get like a lot of this turbo libertarian stuff from. I've seen them argue that if government were not involved, then these tech corporations would be run by as very efficient, like, brutal fascist regimes that get the job done as it should be done, and they wouldn't be doing any of this gay shit. Like, I have trouble believing that. I just do not believe that.
Well, I mean, the culture of these companies is always incredibly gay. So, sure, I mean, that could be. But it's also like, one, first of all, what does this mean? Like, a brutal fascist dictatorship? This is another thing that I think is interesting, because it's all programmed stuff, right? What does that mean? And then Mulbug kind of enhances that programming, if you think about it. Like, is this, it means that, like, it's not pleasant to go to work? That you don't enjoy the work environment, that it's hellish for you or something? You know what I mean?
I'm putting words in their mouth.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But they're saying that these tech companies would be even more efficient, be able to actually operate while they should be, like, advancing and progressing humanity and not being bogged down in all of these, in all this woke capital and whammy issues and all that, if it weren't for the government that were imposing this upon these tech corporations. I've seen them make this argument
before. I fucking don't believe that for a minute.
No, I don't believe it either. Because like, the thing is that the woke capital, the thing I don't like is the separation of government and business. Because that's the thing that conservatives always do. They create this separate, I'm like, no, this is a system. Okay, it's a system. You're up against, because these people are all meeting with each other. Because who gets a meeting with congressmen and senators? It's always big business leaders and stuff, right? And the more money you have, the more you can get in the president's ear, you can get in Congress. Like, these people are all part of an elite system.
And but, I mean, just on a basic level, it's like, you mean to tell me that you can't design a proper web browser that doesn't crash because of the government? Like, fuck you. Like, just basic components of software don't work due to government regulation. Like, tell me how. Explain to me how that works.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess because the government, like, I'm just gonna, like, I'll try to argue on their behalf. I guess that what they would say then is, well, because a lot of these guys are race aware, so, you know, if we didn't have the government having to dictate, like, racial quotas and the like, then you could just create a company out of the most efficient white and couple handful of Asian guys that you possibly could. Like, this is, these are just arguments I've seen some of these types make. I don't know how, like, it's just hard to know if it should be taken seriously or not.
It shouldn't be. It's because, like, look, it's, first of all, it's like, all right, fine. Like, but so what? Like, because the companies don't really have,
it doesn't, like, what, is there an example that you can give me? This is the thing. It's like, it's hard to, I used to be very convinced by this, and on some level it's true, because every company has, like, the black guy, who's just the black guy that's there to be the black guy, and he doesn't really do anything. In one company that I was working at, he was a graphic designer, supposedly. They never used his designs, but they gave him Photoshop, he played with it, and they paid him. That's easy, right?
Did everybody have to put their cubicle next to his and be his neighbor? Is that how?
No, they didn't have to. Some people, like, wanted to be like, hey, I'm friends with the black guy. But he was, like, on the graphic design team, and he would, when they were designing something, he'd go into those meetings, and I don't know if they used his designs. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't fucking know. But, like, then I knew another guy who was a, you know, I actually only knew this guy online. The guy, Yitz Jordan. You remember Yitz, Alex?
Oh, yes. I know that dude.
Yitz was literally, he was like a black Jew. dreadlocked black Jew who would brag that he could like collect multiple salaries from companies as the black guy, and he would try and quit, and they would beg him not to quit, and they would just be like, all right, like, we'll just keep you on payroll and you don't have to come in. And it's like, okay, that's fine. You know, and if I guess they're saying that this is like a serious blow to efficiency or something, whatever. But the point is also, like, what that shows to me is that white people have some kind of this systemic problem isn't that, like, companies are being thwarted in their super efficient management techniques. I'm saying white people are just getting fucked. Like, you have a system that is just deliberately disempowering whites and giving special privileges to people for not being white. Like, let's talk about it that way. And if tech companies would be improved, then so be it. But I don't think that means that they have the qualifications to run the state. And on top of that, most of the social prejudices, which are elite, these elitist social prejudices, the anti-whiteness and the pro-homosexuality, that's all coming from rich people. Yeah. So
the common thread I constantly see, and I think that's what it's important for us to keep our eye on, is just how much so many of these little rabbit holes that they want people to go down to include baked into a disdain for anybody who's got, like, a white proletarian kind of culture to them, or the white working class that, like, are that way in a cultural sense, like what we might call the kulaks, the yeomans, whatever term we want to use, but just that essence of what they consider to be unwashed white people. Like, we're supposed to distance ourselves from that and go down these rabbit holes to avoid getting that, like, little that icky taint on us if we, you know, even associate with that.
Yeah, and it seems like that's an unwritten rule that everyone wants to follow, and the neo-reactionary thing is that as well. So they have these things where it's like, oh, wow, you became aware of race science, right? And so you're now interested in race theory, and you understand that it's real, and you understand that you know, black people are a particular outlier in the field of race, but certainly whites have you know, aggregate differences with you know, people we call Latinos or Mexicans. You know, people always want to argue about what to call them, but we all know what they are. Mestizos, etc. There's aggregate differences between whites and them, and
people of tortilla.
Yeah, people of tortilla. So we all know this, right? And so, and we can prove it. It's all can be shown. And then Arabs and Middle Easterners, they have their differences, and it's not purely IQ. A lot of it's temperament and attitude and culture and things like that. And it's a little bit unknown, not unknown, but it's harder to express because it's not purely quantifiable. Or, like, I just prefer. Even if there was, like, a community of, like, Arabs, there was, like, the same IQ, as like I would still rather be with whites, probably lower, even lower IQ whites, just because that's who I'm like. It doesn't, I don't care about your, that's the thing, like IQ nationalism would have you, okay, so you would say we should bring a lot of Chinese in. Well, China is known, despite their raging industry, for having, you know, 20 times the amount of workplace and occupational accidents as the West. So obviously there's some difference there in that white people are more fastidious and more careful in how they go about. That's just one thing, right? Because these are people supposedly have IQs that are equivalent or higher in terms of spatial IQ than whites. So this is not just about IQ. That's the other thing. The IQ nationalism thing, that's the thing that gets in the way of you just being like, I'm just for white people. And this like cultural disdain for rural white people or working class, it's all baked in, and all of these supposed fake right wing ideologies are deliberately structured along to fit right in with that consensus.
I'm glad we never see like the IQ nationalism stuff anymore. But I mean, if it pops up, I gotta ask these people. Do you think the 105 IQ Chinese person? Do you think he's going to have more affinity for an 105 IQ white person in the United States or the 85 IQ dirt farmer that's also from China? Which one do you think he's going to go to bat for? IQ is not a race. It's just not going to translate. It's always us that have to be like, we're the ones who always have to make exceptions and to carve out different, like, new interpretations in order to mollify some power that might threaten us.
Well, it's like you're expected to import substitute whites instead of just increasing the population of domestic whites. Like, well, let's find somebody that's kind of close to us, somebody that's roughly equivalent IQ. We can't make more of ourselves, though, or encourage production of more native white people.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, if a bunch of white trash people make 12 kids, we'll pick some of them out. We'll raise we'll pump those IQ numbers up if we have to. We can handle that. I don't need to go looking for extra, you know, looking for off whites to be able to fix that problem. We can fix it internally.
Yeah, and it is interesting how, you know, it's funny to think about when, because you know, there's like this third rail. You know, to use the term, there's this third rail. This is going to be edited into the intro of that show now.
That's the longest intro.
Here's the thing.
That you rail. Can't... There is. It's like white people, as Kevin MacDonald says in the intro to your show, whites as a group having interests and protecting them is the third rail that you can't touch. And there are multiple dissident types of politics that will deliberately, while knowing about race, while understanding this and pretending to be edgy, and a lot of them, some even knowing and understanding the Jewish issue, will eschew this. And it's like, you can't do that. And you can't eschew that this is the ultimate purpose of it. And then, you know, there's the ethnostate thing, and then people feel like, well, I don't even understand the ethnostate, like, because that's not something that is it seems tangible, and that I can understand that, but that doesn't mean that you can't. And then it's sort of like the only way to go to bat for whites in the current environment is advocacy for like a pure white racial state. And I'm like, well, I actually think that will hold us back, because so few people can even imagine the circumstances in which we could create that right now. So what I'm saying is, white people are a group. This is my new thing. I think everyone's on board. We're a group, and we're discriminated against as a group, and we're under a regime that is doing this. And so the only option here, we could talk about ethnostates and pure racial categories or whatever the fuck later. Hitler actually didn't like that stuff. He actually did not like the Nordicist stuff. He was like, this is a problem. He's like,
part of it was because so many of the Germans fell under what would have been considered the Alpine race, and Lothar Stoddard was a massive Anglo supremacist, and he had issues with that. He even had like cultural cringe, kind of like racial cringe issues with what had happened to the Germans that over the centuries of them kind of becoming a very fractured people. And you add into that as well, like, he actually in Mein Kampf makes fun of some of the more LARPier, Volkish elements that are completely out of touch with the regular German people. Like, he wanted there to be coherence. Like, this, I want this to be something that the average German can identify with easily without having to go through these weird hoops or
right.
going down these weird rabbit holes.
Dude, there was autistic, and reading, you read about the Third Reich, you're like, dude, there were like really autistic race people in that regime. And yeah. Hitler had to always be like slapping them down and be like, no, like we're just Germans, like relax with this shit. Like I don't
Hitler was the moderate Nazi.
Yeah, he was. Hitler was like, he was literally like he was big brain, like centrist and moderate, because he's like, look, he was literally telling them, I mean, in our language, what he was saying was, this is autistic shit that is going to like freak everyone out. And it's also going to create divisions where they don't need to happen. Because he's like, if you start dividing us, he's like, if you say there's like seven racial types in Germany, then people are going to start creating hierarchies of those racial types, and it's just going to create a problem. They're going to start finding ways to classify them as this or that, or, you know, like pure, I'm pure Nordic, you know, like look at you, you stupid grug brain Alpine or whatever. Like, it's dumb. And it's like, it's for autistic people, and it doesn't help anything. It doesn't raise the stature of the nation state in any way. So that's why, but you know, obviously you want the German race, like you want to create the German people, and that's obviously, you can't have like blacks and stuff coming in, things like that. But it's all within reason, right? That's the main thing. It's sort of like, okay, so, and this is what they use against us now. They try and use autism against us. So, you know, you talk about whites, because that's what we are in America. We're just white people. I'm sorry. Like, there's regional differences, but they're not so great. They're really not that big of a deal, honestly. And then you could talk about various different European ancestries. The funny thing is that in America, because it's like we're even one step above that, what they had in Germany, we have whites now saying, well, I'm this type, and it's all based on what nation state in Europe. But then in Europe, within that nation state, people are like, well, I'm this, I'm Nordic, I'm Alpine. And it's just, it's autism. There's no need for it. I mean, it's one thing to appreciate your European heritage and where you're from. But when you start ranking that and creating hierarchies, it creates a problem within white people in America that doesn't need to exist, because it doesn't matter. Relative to the power structure, you're still white, and you're still not getting into Harvard. You could tell. You could go there and tell them you're pure Nordic blood, and see what happens. You know,
people
so,
are getting into haplotypes now as well. So you got that, like a new level of autism.
This is like the real scheme of 23andMe. Was just to like unleash a new level of autism. It's not even just to collect your DNA for like nefarious purposes. Like, let's just get these Spurgs arguing about weird like.
The next 23andMe update is going to give us Pokemon like types that we all have to, like, that we're all going to be like genetically prone to. It's like, well, Mike's like a fire type, and oh, here's Borzoi. Yeah. He's a steel type European. They're just going to add a whole new level to this.
Did Hitler give an opinion on whether or not Italians are white?
Here's the thing. So one of the things that was very important for German nationalism, and actually led to a revival of it in the 19th century and in the 20th century, in the early 20th century, really kind of like the second half of the 19th century, like 1850s on, and then, you know, between 1848 and 1872, it's very complicated. That was where the German nation state was carved out by, you know, Bismarck, etc., and all that stuff. One of the things that was unifying was Arminius, and Arminius was the German tribesman who united a bunch of Germanic tribes to slaughter the Romans at the Teutoburg Forest and a few other battles, and they then also drove the Romans out in other ways. And they, because of this, they created sort of the division in Europe between the Europe, and later on that became reflected in Protestantism versus Catholicism. But they had pushed out the Latin influence, the Roman influence, from Germany, whereas you had it in the countries of the Romance languages, Spain, France, Italy, etc. And so Germany has a cultural difference from those countries. And then when you go north, you have England, and then you have Norway, Sweden, Finland, you have the North Sea, which is what they're calling the Nordic Mediterranean. That's the body water around which the Nordic type peoples, the Northern European peoples, that's how where they congregate. And you have the Mediterranean type peoples. And that's really the main, I would say, if there's really a big, really important difference, there's those two, sorts of Europeans. And they were always very happy. Germans are always very pleased. And they used Arminius as this unifying myth of them not being Roman, not being a Latin country, not having that influence and being their own sort of Nordic or Germanic type of culture that is different than that Southern European Med type culture. So it's not that he wouldn't say they were white, but he was like, we are different, and we should be proud of the fact that we're different. And they thought they were better, too. Like, let's be honest. Yeah. They thought they were better.
I mean, Italians were classified as Aryan under the classification. They did say that they did viewed basically Italians as superior in the arts to the Nordics, but generally less industrious. So, you know,
well,
just call them lazy.
True. I mean, that's accurate.
The only real conflict that they had with the Italians was the issue of South Tyrol, and Hitler respected Mussolini enough that they, instead of going through this autistic turf war over it like they had in World War One with between Italy and Austria, it's like let's work out the issue of South Tyrol. And for those who don't know, South Tyrol is a city, is a area of northern part of Italy that's primarily German speaking.
Is it part of Austria or Italy now? I don't even know.
No, it's part of Italy right now.
Okay, all right.
And it's historically been part of Italy since Italy became a nation state, and that was a huge fight that constantly went on between the Austrian Germans and the Italians. And when after the Anschluss, Hitler basically was like, we'll work out this diplomatically with Mussolini.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing. So that's the issue. But certainly the other funny thing is, you know, people take Hitler. Now, there's arguments over whether the book Table Talks is forged or real, or are these real, you know, but whatever. Let's assume that it's real for the sake of conversation. Hitler made comments about Slavs in his Table Talks, and they weren't the most complimentary. They weren't terrible, but it was mostly like, oh, yeah, you know, those Eastern Slavs, like, they're really stupid, so let's not really spend a lot of resources trying to educate them right now. Like, we mainly, you know, that was mainly what it was, right? And like, those are the types of comments he would make. And it's, so it's like, okay. So, in the, what they call the general government, the Slavic-occupied, Polish and Slavic-occupied eastern territories that the Germans had taken over in the war, he was like, yeah, you know, we don't need to set up, like, extensive public education for these people because, you know, they're dumb anyway. and it's like, I'm kind of like, is he wrong? Is he wrong? But we're supposed to then believe from that this meant genocide, right? But my thing is, like, let's hear Winston Churchill or FDR's Table Talks. Let's hear how they talk about niggers or Arabs. Let's hear how they talk about, like, people of other, or even non-Anglos, you know? What do they have to say about Italians? What do they have to say about Irish? You know, let's hear Churchill's Table Talks talking about the Irish. And if you have to apply the same standard to him that you apply. Now, Churchill actually gassed people. That's the other thing. He actually gassed people. He gassed Arabs. He recommended that the government literally gas Arabs during the occupation, the British occupation of Egypt, in which he was some kind of commander there. I don't know what his rank was. But he was telling, like, there was Arab uprisings, and he was like, just gas them. Now, that means, like, mustard gas and things like, or tear gas or whatever, but still, it's funny. He said, like, if they rise up, just release poison gas on them. He's like, that'll work. There's no order like that coming from Hitler. But imagine listening to him talk about the Irish. And if you had this same prejudice that any time he says anything about another group that maybe he has a prejudice against, or he's going to make a joke, or he doesn't like them, or he thinks they're dumb, that means he's going to kill them. Because remember, if Hitler says, well, Slavs are kind of dumb, that means he wants to genocide them, right? That means he wants to genocide them. It's the only way you can interpret that. So, again, and it is interesting how that mental block, really, it comes down to this. Like, when you look at the system of National Socialism, it's an attractive governing system. A lot of people would like this kind of system if you could pitch it to them without all these stigmas attached to it, which is why the stigmas are attached to it. They don't have an argument against it. The only thing they have is atrocity propaganda and violence. You know, they can't tell you why it's bad. The only thing they tell you is, well, if you do that, if you have like a comfy left wing and a comfy right wing policy to combined, then you're going to gas people. Don't ask me why, but that's what it is. There's no argument there.
And it should be noted as well that, especially like when you look at the table talks like that, and over the course of the things that Hitler had said over his lifetime, the greatest amount of his ire was always directed towards German particularists. That's where he was always the angriest at having to constantly deal with Germans that wanted to either engage in any kind of like secessionist movement or just split off or not want to cooperate in terms of trying to create a greater Germany, as he saw this as the largest problem, because if all German-speaking peoples were one country, they would absolutely dominate Europe.
Yeah,
that was always the fact that German-speaking peoples had always been fractured and divided for most of their history in Europe was a very sore subject for Hitler, and it's something that comes up again and again when you look at his actual writings and private thoughts on the matter.
Well, it's literally the first thing he says in Mein Kampf. It's like the first thing he starts talking about is like, if we could unify all the German peoples, he's like, everyone thinks this is the best idea. It might not be true that everybody thought that, but he says that. It's like an opening paragraph. But I would say, like, whites in America, this applies to us. Well, how does this apply to us? Because we're not in 1930s Germany. Well, white people in America are just white people. We're not so different that we can't, like an Irish versus a Scottish versus a German versus a Serbian Nordic, you know, say someone with that strange combination, who would be that, you know? This is not so different from other whites that you can't, you know, and in the way that people relate to each other, these things don't come out. Like, you don't have in America anymore. Maybe you did at one point, and it's interesting, the people that sort of lament the loss of that, you know, there's some people that lament the loss of these, of this ethnic particularism inside of America, and I can understand that on some level. But if your political programs to try to revive it artificially, it's not going to work. Because right today, you will not have. I mean, go to a group of friends, of white friends. I mean, the race is the dividing line. So go to a clique of white friends in America and go through. And yeah, it's going to be a good combination of generally German, Irish, English, some Polish, Italian, these are the main ones, you know, some Nordics, Scandinavian. That's what you're going to get, you know, less French. There's not very many French, except maybe in New Orleans or something like that. But that's what you're going to get. That's who it is. That's who's here. And everyone's kind of mixed up with that in some way or another, and it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter that much. So, you know, you can go ahead and pretend like it does or celebrate that you're more Anglo or more German or whatever than others, or it doesn't matter, because you can't visually tell anymore, really. Can you look at an American and visually, maybe Italians?
I do get told I look very French or Russian sometimes, so who knows.
I thought you looked very Chinese.
yeah, I'm like, well, you look, are you Korean or are you Chinese? That's what I want to know. But that's the thing. So, you know, looking at me, you would, you know, looking at Alex, I might, I don't know, I might be like, that guy looks like some hillbilly grug, I don't know. But
he's Alex is absolutely just American. I would describe him as American. Like, he has completed the transformation of the new ethnicity.
Right. Right.
It's kind of depressing, man. I don't want to be an American.
Well, on the
racially, but it like the America as in terms of like the evil empire, no, but racially in terms of the white American race, that's a different thing. It's just what we are. It doesn't matter. You don't get to choose. That's my other thing. Like, we don't have that. You don't get to choose. So, like, stop LARPing. Like, you don't get to fucking choose. Like, this is what you are. And that's why whenever anyone comes at me like, well, what is white? It's like, you know what it is. If you didn't know what it is, you wouldn't be asking me that question. Fuck you. It's like, I care because you do. That's just like that thing all over again.
Oh, it's the best.
If you're mad, response. Then now you know why I'm mad. Like,
it's the best response, and I've used it on a couple of Jews, and they do not know what to deal how to deal with it because you're not going to give them anything else. You're just like, I care because you care.
Why are you nitpicking with me? Okay, that's why. That's the reason. When you explain to me why you want to nitpick on this topic, right there you have the explanation of why I care about it. The very reason that I care about white people as a group is because you want to fucking deconstruct it. How do you like that? How do you like them apples, Mr. Shlomo?
Yeah, you know, in our country, we used to have a division between North and South, and I think even that has basically been obliterated by the racial oppression that whites are under now. Like,
yeah,
arguing about being a Southerner and hating Yankees just seems very superfluous whenever you've got every other group united against you.
I can see, with between New Englanders and Southerners, there being a bit of a conflict. But between Midwesterners and Southerners, because I've gone back and forth down south quite a bit. Other than the accent and everyone's little cultural peculiarities, I've always got along with Southerners very well. I've always felt home there. Like, there's very little difference. So any difference is overstated.
Well, the issue is that, there's also been movement between, right?
So, we have a lot of Southerners up in Michigan, downriver.
There's been a lot of, and look, I understand that if there's Southern resentment that there are carpetbaggers going down. That did happen, and I don't approve of that. But the point is that if we're in the same boat, and it's like, I understand the South gets shat on a lot, but the South gets shat on because it is... Actually, because, frankly, Northern whites should have had more solidarity with the South, with Southern whites. And that is something that was wrong. It was bad that not to do that. And particularly during the Civil Rights era, rather than allowing this highfalutin sense of, oh, we're better, should have had an understanding of Southern whites and what they were, why they had the rules that they had. And, now, you have working class whites in the North perfectly understand why Southerners had Jim Crow. And they're like, holy shit, like, can we get these blacks out of our neighborhoods? The issue is elites. It's always, and it's, obviously, of course, the elite, the tone is, it's mostly Jews, and the tone is set by Jews, but then you always have butt goys that will go along with it, aspirational butt goys. And so I would say that, the Southerners, there is a bit of a unifying identity. Interestingly, how the losers get the unifying identity, right? Where the winners, supposedly winners, it's like, what did I win? Like, do I feel like I won something? They feel like they lost something, but I don't feel like I won anything, So and that's how most Yankees feel. Like, people in the Midwest and the North and the West, they don't feel like they won something in the Civil War. Only people that are really motivated, like Rachel Maddow tier shitlibs, even bring that up. But because they feel like they lost something in the South, they have this unifying, or this loss as a unifying unifying thing to rally around, and that's understandable. But at the same time, it's like, look, everybody is white, and I have no intentions. There would be no intentions of, like, at least people coming from our perspective, like, oppressing the South again. Like, that's not something I'd want to do. Like, we would have, and it would you just be stronger if white people just all to, like, that's the thing. We have the numbers. We have a unifying characteristic. They see us through that lens, and they are trying to get rid of us through unemployment, replacement, migration, drug addictions, or turning us into shitlib bugmen that won't have children, etc. All these different things that are happening, and so together, white people are just stronger, and that's it. Like, there's no other way to look at it, and we could take North America back. If we could do that, and that's really what I want people to kind of understand. I understand it's a far-fetched idea, but it's like, are you tired of being a hated and shat upon, discriminated majority? Are you tired of that? I am.
Solidarity, the white grug against the gay nerd.
Yeah. It's always got to be grugs, too. Like, I want grugs. I don't need any more big brains. We have too many big brains and too much autism. Let's have grugs that want action.
Oh, you can never have too much autism.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about that essay that we were reading on Friday, which, for those that
That was very fascinating.
Yeah. My favorite part about that, and you can tell me what you think about this, boys, and then we can take a break. My favorite part about that essay, so there's a cliff notes on this. This guy was kind of this transhumanist guy who was into like Eastern stuff, and I guess he was doing some psychedelics at one point in his life, and he was like going into trance states and stuff like that. So into that stuff, right? And he was taking a Sanskrit class, and he felt like he had this transformative experience when the Sanskrit teacher taught the students in a different way than he'd ever been taught before, where they tried to remove stop making everybody feel nervous, stop making everyone feel like they're totally in competition with everyone else, make it feel like the class is learning and growing together, and you don't have to be embarrassed if you get it wrong, like everybody's working together. It sounds almost kind of gay, but if you think about it, it's still like very different. And then he talked about how the Wave, that phony fascist movement that this Jewish teacher, that's the other thing we didn't mention on Friday's show. It turns out Ron Jones was a Jew, of course.
I was wondering, because I heard that name. I was like, that's an interesting name.
It's not
name,
a Jewish huh? name, but he's a Jew. He's a Jew, and so, and he said that, he even said, later on, Ron Jones said he got his penchant for storytelling from his Jewish grandmother. And I'm like, well, you tell stories like a Jew very well.
So she told him stories about the Holocaust.
She told him stories, and he told stories. He told other stories. And so he told the story about the Wave, and the interesting thing about the Wave is Ron Jones set the Gentile students up. He gave them an attractive system. He gave them something that gave them dignity and belonging, and then he yanked it out from underneath them and told them, look, you're all evil Nazis. And he kind of reinforced, but it's a story. It didn't really happen that way. But in the story, this is what he was saying. He was doing this, even though it happened differently. It wasn't totally different. But he's telling you he's doing this, so he wants to do that. He's happy to do that. He's happy to show Gentiles, whites. You know, because who else is it going to be? Here's another way for you to learn and interact with each other and the community around you. Oh, by the way, you're enjoying that? That's a little bit too good for you? Well, here, look, you're actually all Nazis, right? And, and like, you know, you're going to gas a bunch of people. And so this guy got, he's like, mind was blown, because he's like, wait, this Wave thing sounds great. Like the way, the discipline, the harmony, the action, the things that they're doing. And he like thought about this for years, and he wrote this long essay. It takes about a half hour to 45 minutes to read the whole thing. You know, so it's like, unlike a Moldbug essay, this one's actually worth it, though. And by the end, the fascinating thing to me was he goes through stages of thought of, like, what is this about? And he, at some point, and then towards the end, there's, like, these interludes where he's, like, been, like, okay, it's been a year. Here's my thoughts for the last year on this. It's been another year I've thought about this. He does that, like, three times. So the whole thing spans, like, 4 years. His final entry is he's, like, you know what, like, he must have gotten a massive red pill on Jews in the intervening year, because he's like, you know, when I learned Ron Jones is a Jew and that he's telling a Jewish story, and then I understand that he's lying, but when I say he's lying and I say he's lying and he's a Jew, I suddenly become the bad guy. And like everybody thinks so, even though they know he's lying and they know he's a Jew. I pointed out and I'm bad. How do they do this? How the fuck does this work? So he's like mind blown about that. And then he finally comes to, like, oh, well, the Jews just control every conversation. They own the me. Because he was trying to do like religious stuff. Like maybe they're tapping into like this inner sense of guilt, or they're doing these psychological manipulations. And they are doing that. But he's like, he ultimately came to the point, he's like, no, you know what? They just own everything. Like, he's like, they just run the media. And that's how they promote these messages. And an alternative message, when you have an alternative message, you're just crushed. So that's it. Like, there's no magic to it, really. That's what blew me away, is he kind of became Grug as he went through. He was like trying to come up with galaxy brain explanations, and then ultimately it was just much simpler than he thought, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, no, it was. It's always funny, like, how when you go back to the stuff, just like how much the stuff kind of just falls into place. And that's the one thing that I've noticed, that whenever people don't want to go down this path. They end up having to just, like, ignore it. There's never an explanation. There's never an once the inconsistencies occur, there's never an attempt at, well, let's piece together what the actual explanation is, if there's something wrong here. Like, it has to be just disregarded completely, because if you can't come up with an explanation, then everything you thought you knew, just, there's no way to cope with that.
Well, the issue is, you can't talk about Jews. And you can't talk and think critically about Jews. And I love when he came upon the idea, like, oh, the way you control people's minds is you tell them that they're smart, and that this is what smart people believe. This is what critical thinking. Like I said, that's what I've been saying for a while. American education doesn't teach you critical thinking. It teaches you what critical thinkers think. And nobody thinks critically about that. And the best was when he was going through the very midwit, pleb-tier explanations of, like, fascist mind control. It's like, there's no evidence for any of that. Like, oh, it's like they put you in a trance-like state and you can only accept orders from the leader and your creative process is... It's like, that's made up. That's made up. It's not true. There's no evidence of it. It's never been true. Why do you think it? Well, you think it because people like Ron Jones have told you that your whole life. And people like Ron Jones have used their position of being an authority, either as a teacher or as somebody in the media that you're supposed to take seriously, or in the movies or something like that. Like, and if they take positions of authority or ownership, and they tell you these things, and they don't allow room for alternate narratives. Good.
Do you remember the Jane Elliott Brown Eyes Blue Eyes experiment?
Yes, that fits into this as well.
That is a type of brainwashing. Like, mm-hmm. if you look at what she does with that so-called experiment, it's actually a type of thought reform, of conditioning.
Yes.
So here you have people, they're using these techniques, but they're using it to try to make you anti-racist and, like, anti-fascist.
Well, they're making you hate white people. They're making you hate yourself, because the fascist threat comes from white people, right? So here you have Ron Jones doing the wave where he gives you, like, a taste of fascism and then induces guilt, and he says, see, like, you Goyim, you whites, you all have this guilty conscience, you all have this in your souls, this fascism, and it's something that is secret and hidden and dirty about you, and you need to cover it up. And, you know, and that makes people that are of this sort of religious mindset think, like, oh, he's exploiting original sin or something. It's like, well, in a way, but it's also like, a lot of times, like, I've never felt the guilt of original sin or something. I never felt like I needed to cleanse my soul.
Episcopalianism.
But I
you know, I'm teasing you, Mike.
No, but you know what I'm saying. Like, that's not something I that I don't have.
I think that's a mistake to look at it that way in some regards. Like, no, it's actually definitely social. Social pressure is what they
Yeah, do. what they're talking about is you're afraid of not conforming to a group, and the reason is because all the authority figures are telling you this is what you're supposed to think. So when you start thinking differently, you start to get nervous. It's not about some inner, I mean, there is an inner psychological stress, but it's not about, like, oh, I'm struggling with my deep soul. It's like, no, you're just afraid of the social pressures because the people in authority that own the media and that run schools have said very differently your whole life, and you don't know if your life will be ruined or some other bad consequences, or you'll be socially ostracized if it's revealed that you think these things. That's it. That's what it is. So it's not totally in a personal inner soul struggle with yourself or something like that. That's kind of not what it is. And when this guy hit upon that, it was like this, oh, there's like yet another revelation, which was interesting. He's like, yeah. And the point is, like, he's a Jew. And you can't, if you can't talk about Jews, you can't talk about Ron Jones. You can't talk about the wave. You can't talk about that experiment and have an accurate understanding of it unless you understand the person that did it is a Jew. And he did it because he's a Jew. And if you can't talk about Jews like that, which you're not supposed to, then you can't really discuss the reality of our social existence. And as far as the brown eyes, blue eyes says, how many people do you know that are under the impression that Hitler wanted to slaughter people with brown eyes? That's because of that test. That's because they went through that brown eyes, blue eyes conditioning in school. And they came to the impression, and the funny is when they think he didn't have blue eyes.
He didn't match up
to his own standards. Like, well, he did have blue eyes, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, I actually asked that question once when I remember this being brought up, And it's just like one of those things where, because one thing I've always noticed is that they put idea, they've learned that they don't give you a very cohesive idea of everything that happened. They put certain ideas in your head so that when the gaps come up, you fill in the gaps yourselves instead of them telling you that, because they basically prime you for that. Because I remember hearing about all the, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed stuff. And so I wasn't specifically told in a lesson plan that this is what they were about. And I asked, and I didn't know Hitler at the time had blue eyes either. But I was like, so like, then what's going on with Hitler then? Like, why is he the leader of the country? Like, this, like, you can't like tell me like he's just an insane dictator who's killing all the blonde, killing anybody who's not blonde hair, blue eyed, and he's the leader of the country. Can you explain this to me? And nobody wanted to answer that question or even knew how to answer that. It's just one of those ideas that float around out there. You're supposed to accept it uncritically. If you have a question about it, just hand wave as like, well, you know,
you're not even really
insane madman who want to take over the world. There's no sense in mad. That's another thing it tells you. It's like, madmen make no sense. So, you know, if it doesn't make sense, it's just because he's a madman.
Right. And they have a number of different psychoses that they apply to him retroactively to explain him. And they won't, of course, they can't. So basically, the narrative is he was insane yet charismatic. And he put the entire nation under some kind of spell, and those that weren't under the spell were so afraid that they shut up. And the funniest thing was in this essay, this guy was saying, you know, one of the things that, another reason you can tell that Ron Jones is lying is because there are certain elements to some of these Jewish fables that are always alike. And one of the things is they want to libel all the Germans, the whole German race. And they do this by saying, and they pretend, they put this into the mouth of an innocent, someone who's just learning about Nazi Germany. When you're told a story about students learning about Nazi Germany, there's some, you know, plucky young student who's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to learn, raises his hand and says, like, but how could the other Germans just sit there and watch as this happened? And, like, that's the question. It's a tough thing. We don't know. And it's like, really? Have you ever sat there and watched when a cop arrested somebody? I have. You're not getting involved. Like, this is the thing. Like, you can't, like, nobody, like, assuming... It's like everybody sits there and watches when the police drag people away. Everybody. Across the board, you do it. I've done it. When I see the police arresting somebody, I'm like, huh. Okay. I wonder what's going on with that. You know? Like, do you get in? Nobody gets involved. And you don't know where they go. You don't see. It's like, so this is fucking stupid. This is bullshit. Like, no one does this. And also, like, the idea that it was the way they say it was is not true. But on top of that, like... Even if it were, nobody does. And yes, they are unaware of it. Like, it's not, this is not, like, it's so stupid. And it's meant to, like, uniquely slander them. And then, of course, they also find other ways of, like, uniquely slandering whites. Because you're supposed to, in these narratives, like, get really mad when, like, the government of the time past was doing something to one of these special groups that... And of course, you were benefiting from that, and you didn't do anything. It's all bullshit. It's such bullshit. Show me a single person that gets involved when they see someone getting taken away by the cops. And it's not even an honest framing of it, but it's like, even if it were, it's still bullshit.
Yeah. I actually linked that video. I read an article about that Jane Elliott thing years ago, but there's a great video where she publicly humiliates and breaks down someone. And it's really funny to look at the way leftists respond to this, like she's doing some sort of great work. And it's like, actually, she's doing brainwashing in the, like, critical sense of the term and, like, the actual literal definition of brainwashing.
Yeah. I think you also have to stress the humiliation aspect of it. Like, I mean, I got shit for, like, the amount that people saying, like, I overestimate how much humiliation is a part of the way that this world operates, the society operates. But I see it as so core to so many things they're doing. Like, if she, you know, that's that presentation you're talking about, that's the key to it, to be able to publicly humiliate somebody so that you can drive that point home and drive that fear into people.
Yeah, so this is the one. I mean, do you guys want to take a break real quick and we can play this? You're not going to be able to see it, but we can hear the audio of it.
Yeah, you don't need to see it, but because like the audio is perfectly sufficient.
is this the her humiliating the student?
Yeah, I think it starts about a minute or so in. One girl starts raising her hand because she wanted to, like, I guess, reject what was going on here.
Well, she wanted to. She didn't like that she was being attacked for being white. I think I've seen this before, and it goes crazy from there. And yeah, this is why I would say you know how you. Well, we'll talk about it when we come back. Let me see if this bumper actually is a bumper. If I'm fucking up this whole thing. Oh, there we go.
You're listening to TDS on the Right Stuff.
Dark Biz.
Perception is everything. White people look vicious and ugly and non-caring and cruel and arrogant and powerful and condescending. And angry. Are you angry?
No.
Oh, good for you. Are you angry?
Trying not to be.
Now, does that take a lot of energy?
Yes.
Yes. Are you holding it in?
Yes.
Yes. And are you trying really, really hard not to react to me?
Yes.
Yes. And are you trying really hard not to look at me?
At the moment, yes.
Yes. Why?
Because I don't want to make myself more upset.
You don't want to make yourself more upset by looking at me?
Yes.
Right. Does that take a lot of time, a lot of energy?
Yes.
Yes. Is that hard for you?
Yes.
Could you develop an ulcer over this?
No.
If you had to do it every day, what would happen to your blood pressure?
It would rise.
Yeah. If somebody stood over you and you knew it was going to happen every day, or you expected it to happen every day.
Oh, that's why blacks have hypertension.
Or it happened when you didn't expect it to. Or it happened to your kids every day. After it happened to your mother every day. Now, getting right along. Your hand is still up. You still didn't learn anything, did you? Didn't I just say when your hand is up, you are thinking of what you're going to say instead of what's being said? Didn't I just say that?
Yes, you did.
And did you hear that?
Yes, I did.
And did you decide that you were just going to do it your way?
I was.
Wait a minute. You were on a roll there for a minute.
Yes, I did.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I did.
Now, since you choose to not listen to others, what do you suppose we're going to do where you're concerned?
No, listen to me.
Thank you very much.
Now,
because you're still thinking of what you're going to say instead of what I'm saying. Now, getting right along.
I heard what you were saying.
You're doing it again.
I understand what you were
saying. You're doing it again.
I don't care.
You're doing it again.
It's wrong.
You're doing it again.
Persecuted her for standing out.
You're doing it again.
Persecuted him for standing out. The only change that ever happens is when people stand out and I was that bad too.
Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. Are you in any physical danger here? Are you in any physical danger here? Is that girl in any physical danger here? Emmett Till was hanged by his neck after he was beaten almost to death simply because he made a statement.
That's not true.
Every time I do the exercise, there is a point.
Okay, so... then it goes away. That girl storms out of the class. I mean, I don't think there's like a couple more minutes, but I guess it's her explaining. But I think we all understand what she's doing here. That is Jane Elliott's racial brainwashing class that she looks like she's doing to a group of students in the 80s. Now, we can all detect the lies embedded in this, I'm sure, which is that she is treating white students the way she is claiming that black students are treated, and this is why they don't do as well. The funniest part of that video, if you watch it, and I wish we could show it, but I don't have Jesse's studio. There's blacks that are in frame that are just yawning and like dozing off and like don't care about the lesson. like it's so obvious that like this is not how blacks feel. Because dude, there's one nigger in the class who's the whole time he's just like, like rubbing his eyes and yawning and like lounging in his seat. Like he just does not give a fuck. He's like, when is this shit over? It's it's really funny.
That brings levity to a very blood boiling situation because listen to that voice of hers. Just every nagging school marm that gets a power trip out of bullying a small child. She started this experiment when Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to bully third graders. She was a third grade teacher. She did this. She designed this for third graders.
Yeah, and these are like older than third graders, but they're probably like 10th graders or 11th graders or whatever. And yeah, she's making them cry. And it feels like the blood pressure thing was almost scripted, though, because like blacks have high blood pressure. Like, I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong, but it almost feels like those responses that that girl was saying were like somewhat scripted. I wouldn't be surprised if she had some accomplices that she had given lines to ahead of time in the class. But that one girl obviously didn't have it. And she got very upset. I don't think she understood the point of the exercise was. And see, the thing is, the way it stops making you mad, I guess, but in a way you should be mad, but you shouldn't be mad at the treatment per se. You should be mad at, like, the lie that she's telling, right?
And that the presumption. I think it's just the presumption that gets me, but sorry, go ahead, Mike.
But she's telling a lie, right? She's saying, like, you don't get... this is, like, the way I'm treating you now is how blacks get treated, and that's why they kind of suck. And you don't get treated that way, and it's purely based on, like, how you look. This is how blacks get treated. And, of course, the thing she said about Emmett Till is a lie. Like, he didn't make a statement. He fucking... he raped a white girl. And his father was shot for raping somebody in World War II, interestingly enough. So it's not... it's not true that, you know, this is like, that's the thing. All these didn't do nothings. We all know this, right? Like, it's not true. Like, they never didn't do nothing. They always did something. And so then she's using this and being like, oh, look, like, they're persecuted. You're not. And if you were treated this way, you would behave this way. But see, the thing is, blacks don't. Because right away, that white girl, at least there was one who was like, no, I'm not going to actually take this from you. Fuck you. And if white people were systemically treated that way, you know, that, like, overt oppression, it would be a lot actually easier for us. But instead, we're treated a different way, which is we're told that we're the ones that are doing the oppressing. It's an interesting mind control technique. And instead of, if they just directly oppressed us, this is kind of almost what the Jews learned with communism and Stalinism or Bolshevism. This sort of direct oppression, like, it galvanizes people and it makes them want to fight you.
Yeah, it's what happened to her and her family in Riceville, Iowa. The reason why she started going, like, into, like, all kinds of workshops and everything with that is because she couldn't teach anymore in Riceville, Iowa, because people were so pissed off by her doing this that her family suffered for it. They were ostracized. Her children were bullied. They didn't want to be anywhere near these people because, hey, you're bullying my children in your class. Yeah. Like, what is wrong with you?
Right. Yeah. And they weren't wrong. Like, the people that told her to fuck off, they weren't wrong. Because here she is, like, what do they need? What do they need your bullshit for in Riceville, Iowa? Right? They don't need your shit. They're fine. They're doing fine. Like, you come in with this bullshit. Like, none of those people shot Martin Luther King. None of those people want anything to do with Martin Luther King. Or any of that shit. They wanted you to leave them the fuck alone. And here you come with your bullshit, because you're a little bit, you know, you got a little bit too much toxoplasmosis, and you got a little too interested in some, you know, early. She's like an early adopter of the Rachel Maddow point of view, and it's just like, no, fuck you, like, fuck off with your sense of justice bullshit, like, get out of here. And so the problem is, though, that, you know, that kind of direct oppression that she was doing. Oh, wonderful. Have we lost power?
I saw a flicker.
Uh-oh.
Are we still recording? Are we still recording? What's up? Yep. It's on. No, we're going. It's on. I had a flicker, but wait, go. You guys all say something.
I'm still here.
All right. It seems fine.
I forgot to turn the backup recording on, but I just did that now.
Yeah, well, my laptop has battery power, so if it goes out...
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
But if the internet goes, then we're done. But we already got an hour and a half under the belt, so whatever. But I don't know. It's like... you know, it seems like it's fine. If it blinks out again, we'll see. You know, we'll see. But anyway, like I was saying, if you just, like, subjected whites to just, like, direct punishment and humiliation, like, calling them stupid and shit, and then it would be one thing, but it's a very clever form of oppression, and they are. So what you teach white people is that they are the oppressors, and so you take that sense of justice and you turn it against us. Like, they take the white people's sense of justice that, you know, maybe not everyone has it, but enough people have it. And you turn it inward. You make it, you focus it on yourself and your own community and on policing us rather than on any outside forces doing it. Where I want to turn mine against you for doing that. Like, I don't want to be like, I'm mad because you're yelling at me, because whatever. I'm mad because you're lying to me. You're telling a lie. You're telling me that we do this to black people and then we make black people suffer because we do this to them, and then you're trying to give us a taste of our own medicine. That's what you're trying to do. And yeah. I see through you and fuck you.
But these people like to claim that, like, fascists were manipulating and brainwashing people, but so much of what they do here is actual, like, Robert J. Lifton brainwashing and thought reform techniques. Like, some of these bullet points particularly really strike me. Like, if you read through his 8 principles here, one of them is seeks to promote specific patterns of behavior and emotion in such a way that appears to have arisen spontaneously from within the environment, while it actually has been orchestrated. The individual then develops the psychology of the pawn and participates actively in the manipulation of others. This is where that thing comes from, where you get, like, these very activated people that come out of these systems where they police everyone around them, mm-hmm. and they think that they're spontaneously doing it. Like, this is something that just their own internal sense of right and wrong has driven them to do this, when actually it was planted there by the thought leaders themselves.
Right. Like, they have an internal sense of right and wrong, but it's been hijacked and used to support the system. And this is where you get rule enforcing cat ladies and stuff like that. And I was saying, like, the other thing I was saying is sort of like, and this gets a little bit complicated, but just think it through with me. We know that the system is anti-white, and we know that it's about hating white people. And oftentimes Jews, because they are conscious of themselves as Jews, understand that being seen as white people hating Jews is or Jews hating white people, sorry, Jews hating white people, kind of a bad look. So being a Jew and, like, openly hate, now some of them still do it, but generally speaking there's some that don't. But the people that are the most zealous oftentimes are whites. Now, the reason is because Jews, one, they have a little bit of an internal thing about, well, we have a sense of ourselves as Jews, and if we're openly attacking whites as Jews, this could become a problem. Also, if they want to talk shit on whites, they can talk shit on whites within their own Jewish circles all day. They don't need an outlet. But when you have white Gentiles that get brainwashed through these systems, that's when I think the true attitude and teaching of the system comes forward, right? So you get the shitlib, the perfect examples of the fact that the systems of teaching are fundamentally anti-white comes through in the attitudes of the rabid, awful woman, or the Gentile cat lady, or the rule enforcing girl that goody two shoes that wants to kill white people, or wants to, like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, those types, we all know what we're talking about, awfuls and such, or social workers and things. Those types are the perfect products of the system. So they reflect its values and its ideology and its teachings the best, more so than anybody else. And so, yeah, so through the lens of looking at this system through people like Jane Elliott, you see how much it is meant to teach you to hate white people.
Yeah, Borzoi is going to love some of these talking points from Lifton here. Like,
yeah.
The language of the totalist environment is characterized by the thought-terminating cliché, the thought stopper.
Oh, I love that term.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. Like, what he's describing is literally how the system operates.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she's still doing this, by the way. She's added a new twist to it. Elliot has made a few tweaks to the experiment itself. On top of the idea of segregation of blue-eyed people, she's added surveillance culture. She puts the blue-eyed people in the middle of the group so that the brown-eyed people can keep watch over them at all times. She's also eliminated a key element of the initial exercise. She no longer switches the group that gets degraded on the second day. Young children might need the switch to restore their self-esteem and get the class back in order, but Elliot contends that giving each group a turn would make it a game, not a hard learning experience. In the real world, she argues no group gets a turn at being on top after they've been kicked around. And that's a reference to the fact that she does this with adults, and she doesn't, like, she's concerned that with adults it becomes a game with them. It's because, like, we don't take your bullshit seriously. You can only bully children.
Yeah, well, there's a whole element with, like, the sessions in which one confesses to one's sin, or coming by patterns of criticism, self-criticism, generally transpiring within small groups, an active and dynamic thrust toward personal change. Because this type of shit requires, like, a group, because they want to use that social pressure to break people down. And that's what they're doing to this woman, or girl, that's in the video here, is they break her down. Like, it's what she's doing. She's being actually humiliated and broken down and then forced to leave. And I think there's more video where they catch up to her, and she, like, confesses that she it was a great learning experience, and she's been enlightened by it now. Like, she completes her programming.
Yeah, I mean, see, the way, and the thing is, the way that you defeat the programming is you understand this programming. Like, yeah. If you go into that room and you're like, all right, this is the brainwashing lady, then you look at everything she does. You know, you look at everything she does, like, what kind of brainwashing is this? Like, what is she trying to teach me?
I'm excited for a brainwashing product today.
Yeah, yeah, I get excited for next brainwashing. You know, it's like, I mean, that's literally what it is. It's like, Jane Elliott is the brainwashing lady. Like, maybe that should be the show title.
But, I like that a lot,
the brainwashing lady. But yeah, so it's like, yeah, it's like, but again, see, I don't know how old I would have had to have been. I'm not going to pretend I had any particular insight or wisdom at this time in school. We did the brown eyes, blue eyes thing, but I think our teachers felt kind of bad about it, so they made it pretty gentle, where it was like brown eye kids got cookies and blue eye kids didn't, and then the next day they just, like, dropped the whole thing.
Well, and that's actually a very important thing, you know, right there. I mean? This has been something that bothers these people. If you do not drive home this idea of the systemic racism bit, the power plus privilege bit, if you don't drive that home, then they see that as a fundamental failure. Because that was how a lot of us grew up, is that we were told, like, oh, racism is, well, it's when you're mean to somebody for reasons that they had no choice over, you know, over skin color, or that's how we were taught. It's like, oh, it's just like, don't be mean to people who look different than you. It's like, okay, like, I mean, that's something that generally, like, don't go out of your way to be a dick to people. Is something that's very easy to teach, and most people are going to agree with that. But when her whole lesson's about driving home that you will never understand what it's like to be this group of people, and teachers, until recently, did not want to do that because they probably correctly perceived, I'm bullying children.
And on top of that, it's also, like, it's not true.
Yeah, well, what she's doing would be more geared towards creating, like, zealous Antifa social justice warriors. Like, you don't want to apply this to, like, a population group at large. It's not going to work.
Right, but it will, out of that will come, you will cultivate a few Antifas out of it, right?
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, man, the funniest shit, and this is in a way, blacks have a bit of an advantage into these things, because they don't take it seriously. They don't take white people's schools seriously. So they look at Jane Elliott like, yo, that lady yelling all the time. Like, what's up with her, right? And, like, it's so funny, the blacks, it's like, if you pull yourself out of, like, being mad about it, and you look at the video, and it's too bad. Maybe we can look at it again sometime, or just watch it on your own. There is a black guy in that class who is lounging and yawning and like squeezing his forehead, like rubbing his brow, and just like waiting for it to be over and looking at the ceiling, and it's just like, he doesn't give a fuck. He does not give a fuck. It's so funny.
When the
that's
old
like,
white,
that's really the how old black
white
people.
Lady teacher gets mad, like, they often find that hilarious when they get like, when,
oh,
when
the dude, old, like, that's the thing.
Gets
right.
So upset.
That is the thing. I've seen that. I used to remember that in school. Like, the black kids, like, the old white lady, if she got mad and was yelling, like, white kids would get, they'd feel ashamed, and they'd, you know. But black kids just don't take it seriously. You can't tell me they're oppressed in this particular way, because they're not. Because if Jane Elliott did that to a black person, with the way she says that they're treated all the time, they would be like, shit, like, they don't care, like, that. So it's like, that's the other thing about it, is that it's a lie. Because, and that's, I think, another reason why the teachers don't really want to do it, because it's really, it's like, just be mean to kids arbitrarily to teach them what it's like to be the subject of arbitrary meanness, right? But that's not how blacks ever experienced any of this. You know, that's not how, that's a lie in and of itself about how any of this works. right? Which is like, so none of those teachers ever did that themselves. Like, they're not arbitrarily mean to the black kids. So to do this to the white kids, or just do it by brown eyes, blue eyes. Of course, the other funny thing is all blacks are going to be in the brown eyes clique, right? So it's like, you know, that's the other funny thing, is like, it's only ever going to be white kids that are blue eyes, and they picked the blue eyes to be oppressed. It was the way that they did it in my school. But it was literally just like, if you're brown eyes, you don't have to do homework today, and you get extra snack time or something like that. Like, it was nothing. It was no big deal. But they didn't do like the, you know, you're like oppressing blue eyed kids. Also, kids didn't really do it. Like, if they were told that, like, you're allowed to, like, oppress these kids or something, you know, they wouldn't have done it. Now, the Stanford Prison Experiment would have you believe that they'd be, like, putting them in showers and beating them, you know, with billy clubs and shit like that or something like that. But, like, it's not, you just don't, like, the kids just won't do it. They'll just stay with their friend groups that they had before. Like, if they were friends with, they would just stay friends with the people they're friends. So it doesn't matter. So this is all just bullshit. And the thing it is meant to do, though, as you said, is cultivate out of these lessons. There comes a couple of people that become real big system people, real big advocates for the system, social climbers, aspirationals. It's always usually more privileged, educated people that they want to become system enforcers. And so it's sort of, it's almost a lesson in teaching them how to be a system enforcer more so than it is a lesson for white people or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you get some Janissaries out of this operation. Mm-hmm. And one of the critical notes that Lifton was making here is that once you've got somebody programmed this way, it's very hard to break them out of it. Like, they absorb that totalist worldview of us versus them, good versus evil, black and white thinking, and they're stuck with it for pretty much the rest of their life.
It is. I broke it, but I can tell you it was very, very difficult for me to do that, because you feel this. One thing they instill within you is this very, very deep sense of guilt, and you might not be able to quite, especially when you start having questions and concerns, you might not be able to quite put your finger on what the issue is. But that deep guilt you feel about, like, oh, but this is going against everything I've ever been taught, and this is just. Now do I have to go genocide people now? Like, what does this all mean? You feel like if you accepted that programming, or they were able to drive it into you quite handily, it's just, it fucks you up for a long time to come out of that. It really, like, it is psychological torture. It is, like, I mean, like, we say brainwashing, but I don't think brainwashing really drives home how much it messes with a person's head. Like, you have to have, like, actual mental wellness to be able to come out of it after a while, to kind of see the world for what it actually is without going insane from it.
Right. It's like that guy was talking about with the wave. Like, you have to be able to stand outside of it and critique it. Like, you can't, you know, like, you know, the way you understand the Ron Jones and the wave is you have to take a step back and look at it from the outside and understand who are the players, what's going on, why are they doing this, you know, that's the other thing. It's, and they don't, and in some ways, like, that's a aspect, that's, you could call that, like, a critical theory, right? And a lot of people will attack that as, oh, that's part of Marxist postmodernism or something, but I'm like, well, whatever, who cares? The idea of that type of criticism of a system, maybe it originated with Kant or something like that, I don't care. I will use that to my benefit if I want to. And when I see their systems, like, I understand that this system has produced all of these people with these weird fucked up issues, and a general consensus of either, like, we don't talk about race, we don't talk about the issue with Jewish power, and there's people that are more or less aggressive in enforcing that. Some people just want it to go away. They don't want to talk to you. They just clam up. They're not interested. Some people just aren't interested in politics, period. And then other people are really zealous enforcers of it. And then other people are really zealously opposed to it. But you have to be able to understand and critique the system for what it is and why the people are doing that. Like, why is Lynn Stewart... Is that what her name is? Right? Lynn Stewart, or Did I get that right?
Jane Elliott?
Jane Elliott, what? Sorry, not Lynn Stewart. I was thinking of another woman. Lynn Stewart was another one of these really shit liberals. She's the one that was always defending, you know, terrorists as a lawyer. Anyway, why is Jane Elliott doing this? Why is Ron Jones doing this? Now, Jane Elliott isn't Jewish, but she has really adopted that worldview. Ron Jones is Jewish, and he is doing a very... His is almost like more Jewish because he's doing fascism specifically. He's not teaching white people, like, you're mean to blacks. He's teaching them, like, this is how white people ultimately, like, exclude Jews or create a totalitarian system. But it's such a fake system. And the interesting thing is that what...
The silver bullet. I mean, that is like kind of like the biggest evidence right there, because Jane Elliott, as much as she abuses her students, doesn't attempt to pathologize them.
Oh, really? Interesting. Because I didn't notice that. So wait.
Well, elaborate. It just occurred to me because, like, when you were talking about Ron Jones, with the wave has, like, encoded within that, like, oh, what's this pathology that makes people want to join these movements, these mass movements, and the mm-hmm. like? And that's a huge aspect of when they're doing, or when you see Jewish people doing this kind of deconstruction, is that there's a pathology. Like, remember with the Century of the Self documentary, you mm-hmm. had that psychologist that comes to the United States. He was deeply interested in what's going on in, like, in the minds and hearts of these little towns across America. There's a deep interest in pathology among them, whereas with Jane Elliott, it's just like, you don't understand how bad it is for blacks, so I'm going to berate you for that.
Yeah, and in a way, that's a difference between the Gentile and the Jew. And the Jew understands that fascism, in their mind, the idea of fascism just means anti-Jewish, okay? So I've noticed this my whole life too. Jews will refer to something they perceive as anti-Jewish as fascist. They don't care about Mussolini's doctrine of fascism, or what, you know, that book Fascism, what is it about, or even National Socialism. All right? No, fascism is anti-Jewish attitudes, right? And so ultimately this manifests itself in certain ways, though, and one of the ways that it did was in something like something like the formation of the Nazi Party and, you know, the SS and things like that. And these were people who understood, I mean, what Hitler did, he understood that the Jews owned the media and pulled on several levers of power. And his thing was like, well, the only lever of power I can pull is the German people themselves. And he had a lot of advantages about time and place of when he wanted to do that, because one, it was, you know, radio and television were not, they existed, but they were not as widespread forms of brainwashing. So most people had to read newspapers, and relatively it's easier to put out your own newspaper than your own radio or television or whatever. And on top of that, he had the generation that had all been in a war together. So he had the camaraderie of all Germans that had been on the front lines or felt like they were on the front lines together. So he could tap into those two things that were very advantageous for him. So he could go out amongst the people and talk to them directly. It's very harder, much harder in a society that has been sort of poisoned with liberalism for 75 years now, for people to go and do that. And so that's an advantage that he had that we don't have. But the point is that, and you know, what this guy kind of started to understand was, he was like, you know, Germany wasn't really, he's like, was Germany oppressed, or did they find a different type of freedom? Like, did they find, through this sort of collective mentality that was developed through Nazism, a freedom from Jews, essentially, a freedom from Judaism and Jewish ways of thinking, the way Jewish ways they want you to think, like this individualist liberalism, acquisitiveness, consumerism, the rat race, and all that stuff. Like, Germans found freedom from that. So you could have the freedom of the liberal, which is the freedom to get more money and more things than other people, the freedom to be more, to be wealthier, really, and to act in the economy as you want. But where's the freedom to, like, fully develop yourself into a fully realized person that's in harmony with those around him? That's the freedom that the Nazis offered you. Or try to offer you.
Giving you is like, well, you will, you, instead of freedom, you'll be hit with decision paralysis all the time because you'll be choosing between a bunch of products that are all essentially the same thing. But your life will be bogged down by making these dumb little decisions instead of focusing on what actually matters.
Right. Well, the thing is that, like, decision paralysis isn't really a thing for people. I mean, it can be a thing, but it's like, it's not like you go to Walmart and you're faced with decision paralysis. Like, people just buy the things that they like. But the point is that it's decision paralysis in terms of, like, what do I do with myself, right? It's not necessarily what do I buy, but, like, what do I do? What do I want to become? And there's nothing to help you in that. There's nothing to guide you in that. There's no place for you. You are set adrift, kind of told to make it on yourself. Like, there's no guild or apprenticeship or following in your father's footsteps or even if you don't know, like, state programs that you can sign up for to learn and things like that. It's all like, go to college, pick some subject, and then go sit in an office or something like that that has nothing to do with anything of what you studied. And so it's very different. It's like, sure, you're free in some ways, but you never feel like you're free. You feel like you're trapped. And so it's just a totally different kind of freedom. And what this guy understood is, he's like, you know, you have to kind of have a glimpse of it. And he talked about getting a glimpse of it when he took Sanskrit class and when this teacher did some mumbo-jumbo Eastern mysticism stuff. And I'm like, that's fine. I'm not into that, but if that's what he wants to do, that, whatever. I don't care. There are people that are into that that are Nazis that would be like, you see, Mike? You see, that's how you do it. You got to get into the mysticism stuff. And I'm like, all right. All right. But, like, you know. But yeah.
Well, that's how atomized you are. It's like, if you have any collective experience whatsoever, whether it be, like, classroom or marching together and chanting some dumb slogan or riding bicycles in a pace line, you're like, oh wow, this is really powerful because I'm deprived of this all of the time. I'm out of my individual.
Right. That's why, like, you know, I used to love going to those protests where we would get a megaphone and we'd stand there and yell at Antifa. I love that so much. Yeah, you know, everyone's gonna, oh, Charlottesville, oh my god, I don't care. That actually was a bit of a shit show. That was not what I expected. But before that, I loved doing that shit, man. I grabbed the megaphone, I get right up in their face, and I'd have like 30, 40, sometimes 50 to 100 guys behind me, and we'd be screaming at these people. It was so much fun. And that's a kind of a thing. And then afterwards, we'd all hang out and party together, and the feeling of camaraderie is great. And sometimes people get that from being in the army, fighting in a battle together, you know. And these are, like, just brief glimpses of it. And in your whole life in liberalism, you only ever get brief glimpses or flashes of it. You never really get the full thing and that, or have that as a lifestyle. It's not just that, it's something you occasionally can experience, some boutique experience that you can have. It's a lifestyle. It's how you live. You wouldn't know any other way to live. That's what the Nazis were trying to do, you know, with varying degrees of success. Yes. Borzoi hot take.
I don't know how. What I mean, it's, you have a great way of, like, just summing everything up. I'm not really sure what to add to it. It's just, it's one of those things that's just, they make you, the thing I've also noticed, that they just make you afraid of even really asking questions. Because think about all the stuff that we've covered on this stuff, and just, like, notice how much of, with the stuff with the wave and brown eyes, blue eyes, it trains you to be afraid to, like, actually ask any kind of inquisitive questions about how anything works, or especially, like, anything in history. Because, like, even though I'm now, like, aware of all this stuff, like, I go back and, like, read a book, like, which is a mainstream book, Hitler, A Global Biography, by a historian who wanted to take a fresh look at Hitler by only going off of what did he believe at the actual time that he wrote documents and had private thoughts, not anything that people said after that he said, you know, they wrote later. What was he saying at the actual time? And one of the first things he brings up in is that Hitler had no animosity towards Slavs. It's like, and it's like, you go through his entire writings and he's got a pity towards some of them over the situation they're in with communism and the like, but he has no animosity towards these people. He does not see them as racially inferior, but we're not allowed to ask questions about this stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the basic like concepts here is like the Totalus Malu maintains an aura of sacredness in its basic doctrine and ideology, holding it as an ultimate moral vision for the ordering of human existence. And questioning or criticizing those basic assumptions is prohibited. I mean, you see this like online whenever a leftist they get a little too close to the fence there and they start talking about maybe it's not just race. Maybe we need to start looking more at the economic and social class system itself. And you're going to get embrace national socialism now. You're turning into a Nazi. Like you're abandoning our central project. What are you doing?
Well, yeah, I mean, the issue, yeah, that's the thing. They want you to be the cartoon Nazi, because then if you're the cartoon Nazi, then you're fitting into what you're supposed to be, rather than actually understanding what Nazism was really about. But
and embedded in that as well, just embedded in that whole idea of becoming like the cartoon Nazi is that then because like that they want that rubber band effect, or they bank on that rubber band effect. Where like now you're not going to question, because you went so far in the opposite direction, you're not even going to question what you've come around to, which is
right.
Whereas like we'll look at the historical record, we'll look at the tenets of National Socialism, we'll look at all this stuff, and we'll critique, like we'll see things like, hey, does this make sense? Does this work nowadays? Like we will constantly be like looking at and reassessing this stuff. You don't want to get into this trap of where like, everything has to be so unquestioned, because that's what they're in, and they want you to be on that side so they can box you in. When what we need is the ability to actually look at what is the actual situation, what is the actual facts, what is the reality that we have to engage with here.
Yeah, and there's an element of like every society is going to have some sort of core belief and ideology that unites it and that you're not supposed to ask questions about. Or if you do, well, the other thing is like what happens when you ask questions, right? Now, people, they always depict that. The interesting thing, the other thing that they do is they depict the society that we live in as the open, tolerant, question asking society. But the questions are never like, let's ask about how the fundamental system of economic distribution happens through banks. So who actually owns those banks? You're not supposed to ask that question. But you're supposed to ask, like, am I gay? Do I like, do I want to have sex with people of other races? I think I probably want to have gay sex with people of other... Do I want to do that? Am I allowed to do that? And so it's like things that people wouldn't really even occur to you in other contexts is like the questions you're supposed to ask, like, oh, is art really supposed to be about showing ideal forms, or can art just be like splashing color all over a canvas? Am I like can I break these boundaries? You know what I mean? Like it's like that's the kind of stuff they want you to ask. Like and yeah. It's like instead of like asking, you know, is this a fit and healthy community? Is this the best thing for human development? I mean, you can ask those kinds of things, but the point is that the basic assumptions of human equality and racial equality, and even though they don't, that obviously isn't true and it doesn't pan out. These are things you're not supposed to talk about. The role of Jews is definitely something you are never supposed to even... You're not even supposed to really say the word Jew. So you're really not supposed to even say that word.
You're not supposed to acknowledge that they even exist.
You're not even supposed to talk about them, right? They're a secret, private group of elites that you're really not even supposed to address. And it's sort of funny how the guy that wrote the Wave blog post, and I wish I knew his name, I don't know it, came around on this. After all of his thinking, where he's like, wait, yeah, these are Jews. They're Jews. And so if you're not even supposed to talk about these people, I mean, it's almost like Jews actually operate the way conspiracy theory people say the Illuminati does. But no one cares if you talk about the Illuminati. So here's a group. You're not supposed to be critical of their religion. You're not supposed to be critical of them as a people. You're not supposed to look at their position in society. You're not supposed to look at the fact that they are controlling major levers of power in media. And the funny thing is there's also the added thing on there, what they do to really big brain people, or the way they get really big brain people on it, really midwit people that think they're big brain, is that you all want such simple answers. Everything is very complicated. This is a really complex system. There's a lot of interest groups pulling at each other. You're never going to know how the whole thing works. I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't think I you know, I'm thinking just like Jews are running this system.
It's like
the answers are simple, but have complicated layers to them. That's how you square that. Yeah. The answers are actually quite simple, but there are some complicated layers to it.
It's like really dark in a layered way that I can't totally wrap my head around.
Well, the other thing about, we were talking about, like, the whole idea of asking questions, like, and this is, I mean, this is the kind of, I'm pretty sure, like, if I were to go look into kind of, like, Schmitt's criticisms of liberalism and the like, I'd probably find this in there. It's not, nothing's coming up off the top of my head on this, but the funniest thing about this regime we live under, which I guess Havel would have called, like, the post-totalitarian ideology, is when you live under, you know, we're supposed to be in constant fear of totalitarianism and the autocratic system, the dictatorship, but you know why, you know what questions you'll ask, and you'll know that will get you in trouble, and you'll know why those got you in trouble. Like, you actually understand the answer. I know you Mike, believe that most people do, are just like, whether they want to admit it or not, believe, they know that Jews have power, but I think there's a lot of people who just don't, they don't know how to process that, so they actually are not able to conceive of it and think of it. There are people generally know, like, I know if I ask these.
Well, they know saying the word Jew is bad. You're not supposed to say the word Jew.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that.
Yeah, you just don't say it.
Like, and they don't. They might not fully get it. I understand what you're saying, that they don't actually have this. Like, they're not like we are, like, understanding it as well as we do, but just shutting up because they're afraid. It's strange though. There are certain messages that everyone gets. One of them is don't say the word Jew. Do not fucking say the word Jew, unless it's complimentary in some way, and even then you got to be very fucking careful.
It's what a weird society to live in, where you know if you say something, you're going to get in trouble for it, but you don't understand why you'll get in trouble for it. Like, you just don't get it. It's like, what's so wrong with me saying these things or even asking these questions? Why is my life suddenly ruined because of that? It's just, what a weird system to live under.
It is very strange.
It's sort of like what Deleuze was talking about with this postscript on societies of control. The control mechanisms are lateral now. They're not just top down. It's like get all these individual corporations that all seem to spin out the same webs of control over the top of you. And it's not so much a case of, like, you literally have the police in their jackboots marching around, like, pushing your fucking face in the sidewalk or something.
This is where you get libertarian reactions to the pandemic, which is they're taking our civil liberties. There's going to be police in the street. They're going to lock us in our homes. And I'm like, what advantage does the system, do the people that are at the top of this system, derive from doing that? And nobody can explain that. And so I'm like, what I have to conclude, and based on their behavior, is that they wanted this to not be a thing. They were hoping it wasn't going to be a thing. And when they realized it was going to be a thing, in sort of panic mode, they then implemented measures that people aren't used to. Because they're not used to it. The idea of just, like, not everyone staying home, or try to stay home as much as possible, try and not engage in contact. And because there's some people like, oh, they don't want us contacting each other. They want us locked in our homes. And I'm like, all right, I mean, maybe, but let's actually think about what they gain from that. Right. And so you have to actually understand what the system is before you can understand it, since it's easy for people to understand brute totalitarian force, which is why Bolshevism failed, why it failed the Jewish A-B test, because people understand brute totalitarian force, and ultimately it can work for a while, but it will fail eventually. But with liberalism, who do you point the finger at? And so then it's like, okay, so we know that it's probably not that they're going to put, you know, APCs with jackboots in the streets to, like, fucking keep us all indoors or spray water cannons at us, or shoot us with beanbags, or, you know, or whatever it might be. They're not gaining, like, who gets rich from that? Like, who, you know, nobody. So what is it? What are they doing? And
well, what they're doing is they've got a crowdsourced social credit system. They don't even need the government to institute it. The corporations have already done it.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. So the system itself is not easy to... And then it's like, okay, well, all right, let's say we're not in the coronavirus pandemic, and wow, American governance sucks. Well, I hate Trump. It's like, right, but is Trump running any of it? He's got some amount of power and influence, but mostly he's like a punching bag for the press, and there's a little drama that's being played out between him and the press, and you're supposed to get invested in that. And then the other the system itself runs on as usual with the same, you know, he threw some roadblocks in its way early. They cleared them out, and now it's just humming along back to where it was before. You know, there's not going to be any interruption in immigration. The sections of wall that are being built, they're negligible, and they're not effective anyway. H-1Bs are going to be right back to where they were. So it's whatever. But who do you blame then? Who do you blame for America? And it's a tough thing because it's like, well, I don't know. I don't like what this set of elites is doing. I don't like what this corporation is doing. I don't like this. But as a set, as a system, it's hard to – you can't pin it down. That's one of the things that's very difficult about – and with it does this to individuals as well. It puts you on a level where you're like, well, what's my next step in life? Well, I have no fucking idea. Who's going to help me? Well, fuck, nobody. Holy shit. What the fuck do I do?
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you got like Google and Facebook and Amazon, they're all in broad ideological agreement,
right?
But they're all enforcing the same social standard.
So that's why it's always sort of funny to me when various conspiracy theory types attempt to make sense of it by finding the one bad guy, finding the one like Google is running this, that, or the other thing, or. You know, or some, you know, and it's sort of, it always feels like a little bit tryhard. It's not that Google's not doing that. Soros is another one. It's always Soros, right? It's like Soros is doing bad things. But Soros is part of a larger complex. And this is why it's hard for them to understand, well, it's actually Jews, right? It's mainly Jews. It's other accomplices, but that they are simply accomplices. And this is a system that benefits them. And the reason it benefits them is because Jews like a system where there's no elites that you can point the finger to. There's no one that you can point the finger to directly and say, they're the bad guy. That's the one that's doing what we don't want. We're pissed at them. Let's take action. You can do that to a monarchy. You can do that to a communist state. A liberal state, that's very much harder because it's so many things. And so being sort of a oligarchy that's running a lot of these mechanisms at once is way better, much more secure position, because it's then it's like, what do you do? What, you know, what do you do? And so this is a very difficult thing for people to understand about liberalism, which is why I think that the one thing we can do to make it kind of simple is understand ourselves as white and them as Jews, and understand that they obviously can't like us. They obviously hate us, and we know this because of people like Jane Elliott. People like Jane Elliott come out of their systems kissing the ass of the system that they're coming out of, and they fucking hate white people. So obviously they're being taught that. I don't know how else to say it. A Jew might be hesitant to be openly like that, but yeah. Anyway,
sorry. By the way, the guy who did that post, I actually found his name, and he was known. Passed away in 2012, Lyle Burkhead.
Oh, okay. Oh, he passed away in 2012. Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, but he engaged in a lot of, like, he went deep down the rabbit hole doing all kinds of stuff about National Socialism and and revisionism. So yeah, he's So I'm not blowing up in a spot or anything like that. He became known for, like, and he's credited with basically busting the whole third wave thing in terms of at least popularizing the myths behind that.
Well, the funny thing about
exposing the myths behind, I should say.
The funny thing about that is that, you know, he collected, because he was so curious about it, he wanted to find people that were at Palo Alto High in 1967, and he found some of them. So he actually assembled elsewhere on his website. Now, the interesting thing is, as Sven was saying, they want to hide that website. Like, they have been trying to replace, you know, you can only find it on the Wayback Machine, and I hope it stays there. I urge people, when you have it, like, download it so it's still, there's a record of it. Because, again, they can take, something is not always existing just because you put it on the internet. That's not true anymore, to the extent that was ever true. It's not. Things disappear, and you can't find them. Try finding some of Meraki's songs. Very hard, unless you want to dig back through old tedious's. But, yeah, like, they want to hide that fucking site. And I guess he did become somewhat known, and he was respected in, like, the transhumanist community, and then he kind of became this sort of crypto-Nazi or proto-Nazi or whatever.
He's got a post on Countercurrent, so I don't know if that was reprinted. Oh, okay. He posted there or reprinted with permission or what. But
yeah, I don't know. Maybe Greg got in touch with him somehow back when Greg was still a National Socialist, and, you know, they discussed these things. But, yeah, I mean, this stuff is really good, and he, you know, I just love the realization he came to after thinking and thinking and thinking, and he's like, he just came down to, he's like, this guy is a Jew, and he's telling a Jewish story, and this is the same story that Jews tell us over and over and over and over again, and it's like, why is it that we must accept, what were the tenets of the wave? Community, discipline, action. Why must we accept that acting on those premises, acting according to those principles, must mean that we are bad people? That we, by wanting to do that and by benefiting from doing that, that we're bad people? Well, the only reason is because there's people that don't want you to do that. And those people are Jews. And so that makes it a lot simpler to understand. Because you look at liberalism, you're like, how the fuck do I make sense of it? Well, here's one way to make sense of it. What's one thing they don't want you to do? What's the one thing that's always pathologized? What's the one thing? And Menzies Moldbug says this, where he's like, you know, they trick you because they show you what they say. Here's a system that sucks, and here's the guy that you hate, and that's Hitler. But they do that. But it's not just Hitler, because it's not. They don't say here's Hitler. They do sometimes say here's Hitler. But it's also like they teach you, as you were saying, they give you the thought that you then put into place yourself. They give you things that are also Hitler, that you have to identify as Hitler. So the puzzle then becomes, let me find Hitler, right? Like, everybody wants to find the Hitler. So when you go out there and you say, like, and people will do it. They've been taught this well. So when you go out there and you say, I want a political movement where we have unity, discipline, community, and action. Someone's going to be like, oh, yeah, okay, Hitler. All right, Hitler. Thank you. You know, and so it's like, all right, well, then that's not me saying I want to be Hitler, as Moldbug says, which is what, and some people do that, and I understand his what he's saying there. But what if you just say, I want these tenets. I want to behave. I want a political movement along these lines. I want a politics that operates this way. Then what happens is they yell at you that you're Hitler. And that's supposed to stop you. So, you know, it's one thing, I get it. Yeah, you put on like the Obernsturmfuhrer Gruppers uniform and you go goose step through the streets and everyone's going to be like, well, that guy looks like an asshole. But if you're like, no, listen, everybody, we're all white, we're all in this together, this system is fucking us over, let's try and be stronger with unity, community, discipline, and action. Oh, Hitler! You know? So that's the thing. It's like the fill in the blanks Hitler. Like, who can find... So instead of Waldo, these libs are always finding Hitler. You know? So,
yeah.
This is wild. One of the thing, I guess, on Lyle Burkhead here, because it has to be him. Like, it matches up too much. I found his old email address. I mean, like, this is one of the reasons why I imagine they also want to bury this, because when you, like, they need, like, the personal assassination, the personal attack as well. But when you look into who Lyle Burkhead was, he was a boomer who was an early adopter to the internet. And was involved and was not just transhumanism. He was interested in all kinds of scientific stuff. And you can find old emails that colleagues and people have archived on a site of him, just kind of like him spitballing about like Fermat's theorem and all kinds of other stuff. Like, he's talking about a lot of like stuff. Like, this is clearly an educated
intelligent man. And then he went down this rabbit hole. He went down, he went on this fact-finding mission. I don't want to call it rabbit hole. He went on this fact-finding mission on something that was kind of like, he heard this, like, something doesn't sound right about this.
Yeah.
And now that he went down there, like, now it's important to scrub any idea, any notion that this guy was involved in this stuff, because they can't say he was a stupid guy. He's objectively not.
Well, that's the thing. He was someone that had gained a certain amount of respect. Right, he'd gained respect in a community of people for being kind of big-brained and knowing about stuff and being, you know, like a somewhat of a authority figure, you know, not, you know what I mean, in that community. And then, oh, well, he likes Nazism? That's not allowed. You know, so, or he has some questions, right? Yeah. And it's funny, it's sort of like, he was saying, you know, he said in that one essay, he's like, oh, yeah, the gas chamber is a good reason to think that that's not true. And it's like, sure, yeah. I mean, that's obvious. Not more than good reason. It's fucking obviously a fucking lie. Particularly the one they show you. I mean, Jesus Christ, that is such a fraud. But yeah. And if they're lying there, like, you know, why aren't they lying elsewhere? That's the other thing. I mean, that's why I think the Holocaust stuff is really important, because without that, because why is Hitler bad? Like, when you say, okay, so unity, community, action, discipline, or whatever it might be, and they're like, okay, you're Hitler. It's like, well, why is that bad? Well, it's bad because gas chambers. Like, literally, it's that simple. It's like, let's not, like, think this too hard. Like, it's that fucking simple. Hitler, bad because gas chamber. Right? And look, again, this is why it has to be gas chamber. Because if it's just people died of sickness or people got shot, that happens in every war. And that happens to everybody. Jews getting gassed is something different, special, and set apart just for Jews, a particularly horrible, and they say this all the time when you read Jews on the Holocaust, all the time. It's a specifically horrible event because it's singled out. They'll either say Jews, they'll say Jews and then a single ethnic group for a particularly kind of inhumane and calculated form of mass execution. That's why they need gas chambers. And if they lose the gas chamber part of the myth, they lose their special status. Hitler doesn't become such an evil guy, and boom, now people can be Hitler again. That's the problem. Really. It really rests on a very thin foundation, but it's at the same time very difficult.
There was something we were talking about earlier, talking about like guilt, and this little thing in this essay, or well, this list of criteria here, where he talks about, the more I accuse myself, the more I have a right to judge you, and that is definitely like a thing with the way that he's
Oh, dude, all right, that's going, I think that is going back, I don't want to get involved in religious stuff here, I think there might be a little bit of Christianity in there.
Well, when I saw that, I mean, Nietzsche's concept of the bad conscience, where you basically self-punish yourself and you think that you deserve it. Like, that's how you justify it, is I'm a sinner and bad person, therefore I should be punishing myself in some way. And then with, like, shit libs, they take this to give them a justification to then turn around and police everybody around them.
I think that's wrong. Shit libs are like, I punish myself, that makes me a good person. You know what I mean? No, think about it. Because like you said, like, why? Otherwise, why would you do it, right? I punish myself. They don't punish themselves. They love it. I punish myself. I'm a good person. Now I can punish you. What I really want to do is just punish you. And I'll just give myself the license to do that through this other mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I think is going on here. Is it's like basically giving them another outlet as a way to get that energy out and attack somebody else with it.
Yeah.
It's really quite astonishing to watch.
Yeah.
And that's why they'll talk about, like, well, you know, I also have white privilege, and they'll say that and then immediately go right straight back to attacking whatever white person is in their sights at the moment.
Right, yeah. I'm interrogating my own privilege by, you know, attaching the electrodes to your nuts. You know, like, that. You know, that's what they're doing, and it's just like, yeah, you're elevate. What you're doing is you're grandstanding, and you're trying to take like an elevated social position by signaling that you are someone that has fully adopted the consensus view, and are willing to punish others for nonconformism to it. I mean, that's what it is, and it's sickening. And I would say, like, there are systems of power. Every system of power is going to rely on ordinary people adopting it and then wanting to enforce it within their own communities. But the particularly like twisted and fucked up way that this thing operates, I think is makes it like worse than other things. So it's sort of like if you're like in Germany, this is the other thing. It was sort of simple. It's like, bro, you're not really pulling your weight. You know, everyone here pulls their weight, and you're kind of slacking. So get your shit together, and maybe things will escalate if you don't. That's like a little bit more honest than you know how liberalism operates with all this weird guilt shit.
Yeah, no, it's really I would like to do more digging into how this like relatively sophisticated system of programming people. I mean, obviously, you got to have institutions do it right. This only really thrives if you have a public school and public colleges and things like that that you can staff with the right people to start implementing it. But there's a whole lot of this too that's just so widespread in the culture and in the media and the way that it's almost subliminal. And the way that everything you come in contact with is like an after-school special trying to teach you certain moral lessons that you need to incorporate into your daily life. Like, I was watching a Netflix show the other day. I don't know why. I'm stupid, I guess. And they were showing a scene where a couple, and it was a white guy and black woman, and they go to a gas station, and the guy at the gas pump is like, "We don't serve your kind here." And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? It's 2020. Fuck. I'm supposed to believe this? I'm supposed to actually believe that this is a thing that happens? Why am I seeing this? This is some kind of propaganda. Like, this does not fucking happen.
No.
This does not happen.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's sort of like, but then you get, again, then you'll get to feel like, this should happen! And it's sort of like, all right, I mean, that's kind of not the point. Like, the issue is, like, why are they showing you this? What do they want you to learn from it? What they want you to learn from it is, like, you suck. That's what they want you to learn.
Yeah.
Like, you are a shitty person. Because that's what they're supposed to do. It's sort of like, and when it's really ham-fisted like that, it kind of sucks. And because it's so alien to people's experience, it actually backfires a little bit. Because people are like, what the fuck? No one does that shit. But yeah. But then, you know, I do think that white people increasingly are getting this sense that this shit, they're being fucked with. They might not be able to put their finger on how, they might not understand why, but increasingly white people, I mean, the polling is showing something like a third of white people will say that they are getting the shit end of the stick, and they're getting it because they're white, which is, that's another thing you gotta understand. It's not just that you're getting it, it's you're getting it because you're white. Because you're white, you're not getting jobs. Because you're white, you're having your communities flooded with opiates. Because you're white, they are moving manufacturing out of your community. They are replacing you with foreign workers. They are telling you in school that you're a bad person. Because you're white, this is happening. And so, and you know it's happening. So like I was saying yesterday, and this got a good response, like, what happens if you're like a white pride type person? You say, yeah, I'm proud of being white. Well, what's going to be the first thing? Well, only people that have nothing else are proud of being white. And I'm like, okay. So at least they have that then. Well, you want to take that? Even like, were you so cruel that the guy who has nothing but being white to be proud of, you want to take that from him too? That's pretty mean. Like, you're an asshole, actually. Just let him be. Like, who cares? It doesn't hurt you, right? And, but then the idea is, oh, no, it does hurt me. But the person doing it is a Jew, so it's like, fuck you. But it's like, that's the thing. It's like, you don't do that to other people. You know, you don't do that. Like, no other person is like, if they have nothing else, at least I have my people. And you're like, no, you don't. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, why can't I just be happy?
It's like, you don't have a lot of material possessions, so you shouldn't be happy about your race because you're poor or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is so funny.
What are you looking at there? Are you like going down a rabbit hole or something?
I went down something here. So, because I'm always just kind of curious. That whole Lyle Burkhead thing got me on a tear. It's like, because the whole idea of like what. It's not just that they can scrub the internet, it's just that people also don't know where to look mm-hmm. for certain things. And it occurred to me, like, why don't I just go look on Usenet to see, like, what kind of stuff people were talking about? And for the Zoomers who may not be aware of this, before you had all this easy searching, people used to mm-hmm. get onto Usenet and just they'd have discussions there. That's where, like, a lot of this stuff originated from.
Probably end up having to go back to it. It's not the one thing about Usenet is I don't think that you can do Usenet over a secure protocol. I'm not sure, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, this is like how it used to be. Like you'd get, and usually it was just for people who were at colleges and universities, or people who were like really deeply into this stuff. That's how before the Eternal September. That's how this stuff used to be. But I just found a thread that kind of reifies points we made constantly on, you know, on our shows, is about how much of what our understanding is essentially folklore. That's a lot of things. And here I found a thread on the wave, and here's all the elements that are discussed in this. Here's everything that's discussed in this thread. You have the wave, because people can't remember if this thing was real or not. They remember seeing a movie. Brown Eyes, Blue Eyes comes up because people thought maybe they're getting mixed up with the wave.
Yeah, that makes sense. It seems to fit into the same category of things, right?
Guess who jumps into this thread and is discussing? This is from 1996, by the way. Barbara Mickelson, the founder of Snopes.com. Now they're discussing this, and they bring up the Milgram experiment and the Zimbardo Stanford Prison experiment. All of these different things, like these are all different folk tales we've been constantly.
They're all fake, and they're all folk tales that are telling you the same story, and it's a Jewish story. But anyway, go ahead.
And because this is when the internet was new, and so there was no way that a lot of this information was cataloged, codified, and you didn't have enough people that were that were willing to catalog all this stuff and kind of compile it for people. You still had these folk tales being passed down mm-hmm. and these understandings of them being reified. People were like, oh yeah, I kind of remember that. Or here's like, I did a little bit of research where, you know, I pulled up some articles and magazines that have been published about this stuff. And so, yeah, this totally happened as they said it happened. It wasn't until much later when we were able to do much more robust research and more people had to build upon what people did before that we're able even to like puncture these myths as much as we can now. I mean, there were people who toiled in these trenches for a long time as the sole voice that was not being listened to. But this is why you're seeing so many problems nowadays, is that we finally have had enough inertia of the truth to be able to keep delivering that to people. And that's why they're so desperate to shut
it down. Well, it's hard because if you are a student in America that went to public school in the 70s, the 80s, or the 90s, at that time, how do you even begin to question the Milgram experiment? You get taught it in health class. It's part of the text. The teacher has a lesson plan. Maybe you watch a video about it, right? Like some edited video presentation, and then you have discussion. You have a facilitated discussion where the teacher is told the points that she wants, that she is supposed to put forward, and the discussion is hammered into your head. And, of course, the students, the way you become a bright student, and they're usually going to be girls, are the ones that get it right away and know how to actually sort of collaborate with the teacher, even if they don't have the script. It's something you see a lot. But the point is that you then, after going through that, one, it doesn't occur to you that it's fake, that it's a lie, because you're like, okay, the school is here, teach me stuff. What do I know, you know? And then, let's say you think, that doesn't make sense. I mean, it's also why people, I mean, going back to Helen Keller, that's why people believe in Helen Keller. Because Helen Keller makes no fucking sense. Okay, it's like, it actually doesn't make sense. So, why did you believe? Well, you only believed it because somebody that was an authority figure taught it to you when you were little enough that you just, like, believed stuff. And you never stopped believing because you never thought about it until you thought about it again. And you're like, wait, that literally makes no fucking sense. But again, where do you go if you're like, hey, you know, that Milgram experiment thing, that seems fake. Let me research that. You know, that you need to be a specialist before the internet.
Now, Now, Anne, listen to how, like, because of, these are folktales being passed down, people's understanding of it shifts. And, like, and this is where my point we're talking about, like, where they fill your head with certain ideas so that when they – because when they're – it's the boat and Bailey position. So when they have to retreat back to the moat, then you just automatically fill in the Bailey position for them because that's how you've been trained to do it.
Yep.
You just automatically fill in those gaps. Well, here's
an interesting – Holocaust works this way, too.
Yeah. Well, listen to this. This is from a guy on this very thread that I was looking at. Here's how when they're talking about the wave, I too vaguely remember something similar to this, but with variations. Here goes. In American school, we're being taught about the Holocaust, and all the pupils couldn't believe just how dumb the German public were for following and supporting Hitler. So their teacher decided to show them that it was possible. He created a culture of support around the school American football team. Those who were in the team were the recipients of many privileges, such as getting free tickets to cinemas, etc. They had their own system of symbols and their own uniform. Over time, other members of the class joined in and formed subcliques around the central one, all with interconnecting gestures, signs to allow the various members to recognize one another. The ones who were looked down on were the less athletic, bookish-type students. Those who had the privileges and felt themselves special looked down on this type of student, and they began to persecute them and make them do unpleasant tasks. Eventually, one of the bookish types was beaten up for not acknowledging his superior from the football team. The teacher decided that things had gone far enough and called them into the classroom. He said, "I'd like to introduce you to your leader," and then put up a picture of Hitler. The privileged ones and the bullies were mortified. Now, this stinks. It's got disgustingly large dollops of morality set off in the most putrescent way against the nerd versus jock theme. Thing is, I remember being taught this in a history class, and I can date and time it reasonably closely. Guildford, Surrey, at some point in the academic year 1986 to 1987. It was told to me as truth, but I have never heard anyone else mention it, and I also remember seeing a TV film that followed the story pretty accurately sometime later, and it could well be the wave, as mentioned by the earlier poster. Just another data point, I suppose.
Well, it's interesting. What's interesting is that isn't the story exactly, right?
Yeah.
He's mixing up a number of different things, but it's like, absent the whole story, he can fill in the blanks himself. Because it could be that. I mean, it could have been that, because all the elements are there. He introduced a few elements that weren't in the original one, which is that of, like, jocks versus nerds, which is, of course, we understand from what jocks versus nerds is. It's white people versus Jews. That is literally how that meme is. That is what they're putting forward to you, that the nerd is the Jew. And oftentimes in the Jock vs. Nerd movie, the nerd looks like a Jew, even if he's not. Sometimes it's John Cusack. Sometimes it's a few other actor. But they always look like a Jew. Revenge of the Nerds, clearly Jock vs. Nerd, white versus Jew. Obvious, obvious, obvious. And a lot of the actors were Jewish that were playing these nerd characters. So, interestingly, I believe Ogre was a Jew, too. But don't hold me to that. I could be lying.
I'll look it up right now.
But it's not that important. But the point is that the fact that he didn't have it all, and then he kind of wrote his own story, is very interesting. And he's also sort of – it's interesting how he's also kind of disgusted by it, because he's like, this is so stupid. But it's like, yeah, but you still know the story. And so that's a Jewish story. And it goes – you know, and there's other elements they'll throw in there, like brainwashing, the inability to resist the charismatic words of the leader or something. And that makes you – what that does, that poisons you against ever being moved by someone speaking, right? So if there's like a charismatic person speaking, you're never supposed to be moved for it. You're always supposed to be cynical about it, unless they're making these sort of maudlin Jewish – tear-filled pleas, then you can be moved by it. But they always have to be, you know, it's like if there's someone out there that's urging you to greatness, that's saying you can be more than you are, we can conquer together, we can strive together, we can get better and stronger together, then you have to be cynical because, oh, that's Hitlerish. But when someone's making like a maudlin, tear-filled Jewish, you know, teary-eyed plea for all of us to hold hands and hug, and that you're supposed to take seriously.
Well, I think it's interesting how the left has sort of moved away from, or really J-left, it's moved away from like the cult of personality. Like, they don't really have leader figures themselves so much. They've gotten very adept convincing individuals to think that their ideas and their moral nostrums are the product of their own spontaneity, like came out of their own spontaneous consciousness. That, I think, is a new development that's not been seen historically until recently.
Yeah, and they don't need a leader figure because their leader is the government. Their leader is the system, right? They're not revolutionaries. They're simply janissaries and guardians of the system in place against people who would be Nazis or would try to be Nazis or will LARP or will try to be nationalists or socialists or even people who want to cut immigration or people who want to be patriotic. They are simply system enforcers against that. So what do they need? This is like the leaderless resistance. Well, what are you resisting? You're not resisting anything. You have a leader, and it's actually the fucking CIA and the FBI.
Yeah.
You're
part of a leaderless volunteer police force.
Yeah, like you have no movement. This is the thing about the left. Like, you know, Bernie was the closest thing you had, but he's some geriatric Jew, but he's gone now. I do not think that guy's going to be trying again. I mean, imagine they run him again. That would be quite the show. But it's like, what do you have? AOC or something like that? I don't see it, right? Like, you people don't have a leader because you don't need one, because you're not revolutionary. Your leader is Google, Facebook, Amazon, Walmart. That's your leader. There really is no leader, is there? No, there is. It's Jeff Bezos. You know?
Jeff Bezos is effectively the leader of Antifa.
Yes, he is. Jeff Bezos, leader of Antifa. Write that down, please, Jim.
Jeff Bezos, leader of Antifa.
Yeah. I mean, It basically, dildo delivery is super important to these people. You know, just-in-time dildo delivery. Please write that down, Jamie.
Yeah. I mean, the establishment knows that for revolutions, you got to have leaders. So they've pathologized the idea of having any leader whatsoever, knowing that they can enforce their system without leaders. So,
Right. And that's why the president is always just a buffoon, right? He's a goon. You know, people wanted Trump to be leader. I remember it was sort of funny. Someone was saying to me the other day, he's like, because I was critiquing Moldbug, and he's like, well, he wants a system with a leader that has a bunch of powers, and so do you. So what's the difference? You just want, he wants it to be a tech CEO, and you want it to be some based pro-white guy that doesn't exist. I'm like, all right, like, you can try and, I see your point. But, like, everybody that voted Donald Trump wanted a based pro-white guy that ended up not existing. So, you know, you can pathologize that if you want, or you can kind of mock it or something. I don't think the guy was wanting to. He was just being contrarian. But it's like, no, I don't want it to be an Indian tech CEO. I don't want the country to be managed along the ideas of, like, project management for a fucking tech corporation. You know, where the leaders of free enterprise are to be unleashed to be like new feudal lords or something like that. No, fuck that. And the fact that, yes, it would be ideal if we had a based pro-white president that actually had powers, that could actually act, that wasn't hamstrung by bureaucracy and parliamentary shenanigans and democratic, you know, shenanigans. That would be fantastic. And that's what people wanted when they voted for Trump. So make fun of me if you will, but that idea won the election in 2016. The concept of a strong pro-white leader with powers. People voted for it.
Yeah.
So make fun of me if you will. But you can't pretend like it's politically stupid because people obviously desire it. So, anyway, you got anything more there, Borzoi?
Apparently, when I went to alt.conspiracy.jfk, I found a thread. Helen Keller had more vision
than JFK.
No. Just like it's the Usenet group is alt.conspiracy.jfk. Is that I found a thread titled "Helen Keller had more vision."
Okay, I mean, yeah, it's so funny when you read the stuff that she supposedly wrote, and there's like all these visual metaphors about like walking through doors and looking into the past and stuff. And it's like, dude, she didn't write that shit. Get the fuck out of here. Just stop. Like, just stop. It's so clear. It's like this woman. It's funny. Why do we? And then this is also another thing. Why the disabled woman is this the one you're using for this? Like that's another sick thing. I mean, look, we could go back already to that point where it's like already we see kind of the sickness of this you know, and she was very much sort of a progressive, but in a kind of a, you know, she wasn't Jewish, not from a Jewish family, from a WASPy family, actually. A well-to-do WASPy family.
From Alabama.
And Annie Sullivan was Irish, mostly, and... But why? What is it about the belief system that she's promoting, which was sort of this kind of feminist? This is the SJW shit from their day. What is worship of the broken? Right? Total. I mean, Helen Keller is nothing if not worship of the broken. Why should I care? What? Because a person that's dumb, deaf, and blind said this, I should think it? I mean, maybe I'll be like, wait, why would I trust that person on anything? Not to be mean, but like, they probably don't know shit. You know, like, okay, you're dumb, deaf, and blind. That probably means you're functionally retarded. So I don't think that your political and social views are particularly impactful. In fact, yeah. It turns out they're fake.
The only way to understand that is that it's part of the post-Christian phase of American history where they were still clinging on to some of that stuff.
And that is just weird shit, dude.
Yeah, because you've got similar characters like that in the 1800s and Christianity that had blindness and various problems, and they were seen as extra special because of that.
Yeah, there's actually a documented case in Sweden of a Jewish girl doing this, where she was self-harming, but also supposedly performing miracles or something. And nobody wanted to believe, like, she supposedly had this affliction, the terrible disease. But she didn't. She didn't.
Mingala, he tried to give her blue eyes, and he fucked up, and she went blind.
Yeah. No.
They're always making that allegation.
This was before that period, but it was this girl who actually didn't have anything wrong with her. It possibly even goes to this, like, self-crippling weird thing that some people have. She actually didn't have anything wrong with her. But by being sick, she got the attention she wanted, and then her statements and things like that she was making, and supposedly even like miraculous things, like wise things and stuff that she would say, were getting all kinds of press, and people were liking it. But she was actually just like self-harming. She was like hurting herself, and then getting, and it was like, it came out later on, it became exposed and whatnot. Some doctor finally was like, you're doing this to yourself. Like, these are obviously self-inflicted wounds. Like, what the fuck is this? So I'd have to research it a bit more, but there was an example in one of these books I'm reading where they talked about this idea of like the victim as the morally superior one. It's something that is, of course, for Jews, they're gonna definitely play on that. I mean, that's, you know, that's, they have obviously played on it, but it goes a little bit deeper than that, than just the perpetual victim. Although there is that, but it's also like the victim, but like the perpetual accuser is kind of another way. Like the Jews are a perpetual accuser of whites, and also perpetually evading accusation themselves, because accusing Jews makes you guilty. And fuck that. Like, saw an article today, Jonathan Greenblatt from the ADL is like, it is absolutely anti-Semitic to blame Haredi Jews for spreading coronavirus. I'm like, all right, well, then it's anti-Semitic to observe reality. Like, let's do it. Let's go with it, because they objectively, they are. Okay? And I actually thank Jonathan Greenblatt for going out and saying that, because it actually somewhat makes our case easier, because it's like, hey, you notice how these funny hat, curly hair people that are really ugly and smelly and weird are spreading this disease, but if you say it, you get in trouble. Well, that's kind of a problem, isn't it? Shouldn't you be able to... They're clearly visible and recognizable. You know who they are. And they can say whatever the fuck they want about you. But you say something about them, and you're in a fucking ton of trouble. And even some of your white neighbors will try to enforce that. So that's a fucked up system. That's not a good... That's not right. So yeah. Anyway, Unless you got any more Borzoi, I'm going to call it.
Well, there was one thing I was working on this whole time as well, and I wanted to see, because we mentioned Bergen-Belsen, and it was you mentioned that there was no gas chambers there, and it occurred to me, like, did they ever claim that there were? Because
yes, again,
going to the theme of the show has been like they are going to scrub anything in that they can, and well, I'm sure they did, but I wanted to find like actual, like, what's the citation on this, and it looks like I did find something from History of World War II written by Francis Trevelyan Miller. In Belsen, Kramer kept an orchestra to play him Viennese music while he watched children torn from their mothers to be burned alive. Gas chambers disposed of thousands of persons daily.
Yeah, that's,
prisoners were starved versus a punishment. Yeah, so.
Yeah, they said it about every camp until they couldn't say it anymore. And the reason they could say this is like old school Holocaust revisionism stuff. They could continue to say it about Auschwitz and then the Aktion Reinhard camps, which is, you know, Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka. And they actually used to include Majdanek, but it came out like the curator of the Majdanek museum himself wrote a paper in the last few years basically saying, yeah, by the way, nobody was gassed here.
Yeah.
So, like, this is a narrative always in retreat.
Yeah. So, like, what worries me is that because we know the facts, but we're often not the best at documenting when they change what they say. Like, that's like, and this is a big problem of deplatforming, is that, as you said, like, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's going to be there forever.
Yeah,
we have to keep like record of every time they make these claims so that we can say, like, do you remember when you said this? Because I have the actual proof of it now. You can't like just scrub the internet and say, like, oh, we never said that. You said it. I have it right here.
And that's why the Holocaust historians, the revisionist historians, are deplatformed effectively. They're not, they can still write their books and publish them, but no so-called mainstream scholar is going to touch them. And not only are they not going to touch them, they know that, like, if they do, now you're not a mainstream scholar anymore. And that way it's the circular reasoning of what is a mainstream scholar. Well, a mainstream scholar is somebody who will never look at a Holocaust revisionist book, because as soon as you do, now you're not mainstream, right? So it's sort of like they can say, oh, well, those revisionist books, well, no mainstream scholar takes them seriously. It's like, right, because, again, by definition, taking them seriously makes you a kook, because there are plenty of mainstream scholars who have looked and thought and then said something, and now they're not, like David Irving, like Kevin MacDonald, etc. So, and there's plenty of others too, like what was his name, Arthur Butz, funny name, but he was and he's the funny thing, they couldn't get rid of him
because he's still teaching, I believe, by the way.
That's crazy. That guy must be old, because he did that in like 1979 or something like that. He wrote The Lie of the Hoax of the 20th Century. And
86 years old, associate producer of electrical engineering at Northwestern University.
He must be like, just like, fuck you, you are not getting me out of this job, because like, they've tried to get rid of him and they can't do it, and good for him. I would say until, like, keep teaching classes until you, as long as you physically can, because fuck these people. So yeah, it's amazing. I would have assumed that he would have been retired by now. He's probably only teaching like one class now, but still. But yeah.
There he is. He's got to go to Northwestern University. You can find his faculty.
And every year there's like the ritual department denunciation, like, we know, but we can't do anything. And it's like, yeah, but who's even asking you? That's the other question. Who's asking you to denounce this guy? It's not the students. Right? It's the fucking ADL. It's Jonathan Greenblatt and his cronies. They should be denounced. I denounce them. Can I ask my college to denounce the ADL? Will they do it? Like, what if all the students at a college vote? Oh, actually, no, they do, because a lot of times students at college vote to denounce Israel and they won't do it. So there you go. So it's never the students that are asking for this shit. So, yeah. Yeah. So, actually, one story I did want to tell before we go is really one of, this is a horrific story of a guy named Gottlieb Weiss, who was a guard at Auschwitz. He was a German soldier who was injured. He lost eyesight in one eye And actually, you know, I'm sorry, he wasn't the guard. He was a bookkeeper, but then he was somehow put in charge of certain groups of Jews. And when Auschwitz was, when the Russians were closing in and they evacuated, actually, a lot of Jews, surprisingly, and other inmates decided to stick with the Nazis rather than risk being in Auschwitz when the Russians took it over. Funny enough. So the only people left behind were the typhus victims too sick to move. And according to one report, Gottlieb Weiss, actually, people wanted to be under his command for that evacuation because he was known to be particularly nice to people. And he actually rescued a German girl from Russian artillery fire. And what was his thanks for that? His thanks for that was after the war in 1983, and then he was sentenced in 1985, to be convicted of 5 murders, which they ultimately then reduced to just 3 murders of unnamed and unknown persons in or around June or July of 1944, based on the eyewitness testimony of one fucking Jew.
Don't you have to have a victim to have a crime?
Not when it comes to the Holocaust. That's what was so outlandish. It was literally one eyewitness. So if you think it's like, oh, the women that Harvey Weinstein raped, like this is the bad precedent. Like this is a bad precedent for a long time. You want to talk about? Let's talk about Gottlieb Weiss. Okay, this guy was, and the reason they said they could point him out was because of his one eye, and then they made up all these lies, which are now known and proven to be lies, that there was this rumor of this one-eyed brute who would just, like, no, he was known for just, you know, randomly taking out his gun and just, like, shooting at Jews in the camp, and it's like, you know, and it's sort of like, this is credible to a generation of people fed on, like, Hollywood movies and TV and shit, that this is something that could happen. But people that have been a part of, like, a military organization are like, no, you don't just take out your gun and start popping shots off. Like, that's a very quick way to get yourself shot, actually. Like, it's just, it doesn't happen, right? You don't just start shooting people now because I feel like it, because I'm a meanie, one-eyed guy.
Oh, just like how in Look Who's Back, Hitler just pulls out a gun and shoots a dog, because that's just what that's just what insane dictator Hitler would do.
No, he's doing that. He's just shooting people, right? This Nazi, big Nazi guy with one-eyed brute just shooting Jews. It's like, dude, what if he hits another Nazi? You know, but it's like, well, that's not even considered. So it's just so fucking stupid. And that's a thing, just like the stupidity of it. And it's just, and it's like, it's really remarkable. And of course, this article I was reading, it's like 45 pages long on this case. And it gets you get a little glassy-eyed at points because there's so much information. But the guy that accused him, the Jew that accused him, was just like a known liar. Like he turned up at multiple Holocaust trials, always there to accuse whoever was the defendant. Oh, that guy, definitely, I saw him in this year doing this, and he was like he was at, you know, Nuremberg, he was at the Auschwitz trials in Berlin in 1963, he's then in 1985, he pops up again, like, oh, definitely saw this guy, you know, and it's like, who did he shoot? What were their names? Where are the bodies? What's the evidence this crime even happened?
Well, that's like a thing with these victims, is they did like the Holocaust Grand Tour, where they went to
damn,
every
you beat me
single
to it. I was going to make the same joke.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Holocaust Grand Torino. Right, it's like the circuit.
Yeah, it's the tour to Holocaust. Like you gotta hit all the stages, complete the whole thing. I mean, some of those accounts were just insane. Like, oh, I jumped over a fence and then ended up in another concentration camp, and then that time I crawled through a gap in the side of the concentration camp. There's like a board loose or something, and I squeezed through the gap.
Yeah. My favorite was I escaped.
Daytona 6 million?
The Daytona 6 million. Write that down, please, Jamie.
The Daytona 6 million.
That might have to be the show title, actually. That's definitely going to be the show title, actually. The girl who breathed through the keyhole to avoid dying during the gassing, and then when the SS guards open the door to get rid of the body, she morally denounces them and runs away and escapes somehow. Like,
yeah, you read that last week. I was like, I couldn't believe when I heard that story.
Unbelievable.
I was like, what?
Unbelievable.
Denouncing them as she runs away. It's like, oh, like so these guys just randomly shoot people, but
they couldn't get her. And they couldn't catch her either.
Yeah. Must be like, they must have the sight of those stormtroopers that I get from Star Wars.
There was another one where some woman who was claiming to have been there at Babi Yar, which, by the way, like, still haven't found that mass grave. You know, the numbers have gone down from 650,000 to now I think it's like 32,000 is the number they're claiming. Still no mass grave found. But she claimed that, you know, they didn't shoot her, but she pretended to be dead because they were shooting everyone. So she just played dead, and they dumped her in the pit with all the bodies, and she, like, clawed her way up through all the bodies and then, like, broke through the top of the earth and then, like, hid naked in the woods until, like, she came upon, like, people that helped her, and then now she's here, and there's somebody that seriously tells that story, and, you know, people are supposed to believe it. So, I don't know. We could swap, like, ridiculous... But the other thing is, I'll say this, there's a certain thing that also happens then to defenders of the Holocaust, is they say, like, well, you guys just want to focus on those absurd stories. And I'm like, no, we focus on them, one, because they're funny. I mean, I could do a systematic deconstruction of this, but, you know, there's other people that die. And someday we have, and we'll keep doing it. But remember, like, we focus on those because they're funny. But also, this isn't a thing, as I've said. This story is not a thing where one narrative gets knocked down and the other ones still are of, like, equal value. It's like a tent with poles, and every story is a pole, and you kick out enough poles and the tent is going to collapse. And, like, I simply, if you have a period where people were expected to take this shit seriously and now you know that they won't, so you've abandoned it, how many more tent poles are you abandoning? How much smaller is your tent? How many, you know, they're like reducing the size of the tent, so they need fewer and fewer poles to hold it up, because, like, because it's not tenable, and they have retreated so much. I mean, they had to give up on one of their... They only had 5 extermination camps. Now they're down to 4 because they had to give up on Majdanek. You know, so... And that was just recently. But, anyway.
Yeah, it's just not tentable after a certain amount of time.
There you go. Untentable narratives.
Yeah.
Write that down, please, Jeremy. But, all right. Anyway... Before we go down another rabbit hole, sorry, it's been a relatively long... Hey, we did a long show. We managed to get 3 hours today. Holy shit. This is what happens when Sven is in here. We actually did, like, a very serious show. Although, some funny stuff, I think.
God, you know what they're calling... Like, just because I was looking up some stuff. You know what they're going to be calling now? Like, once all the servers are gone, what they're going to call this? They're going to call it the post-witness era. I found the book, Revisiting Holocaust Representation in the Post-Witness Era.
Yeah, they're already prepping for it. And they're trying. They're also trying to... They're trying to get people excited for the idea that just, like, shooting Jews means there was a Holocaust, because I think eventually they might have to abandon the Auschwitz gas chamber narrative, because there's no way to defend
it. The place is being turned into an amusement park. I mean, like, it's already just being discredited on that alone.
Yeah, and also, it's like, the thing is, what they show you there is absolutely a fraud. And so they have to then say, well, the other place is Birkenau, which has been destroyed. That's where the bad stuff happened. Which is actually, according to the Orthodox narrative, that's true. It did mostly happen at Birkenau. So they're already showing you, like, the place it didn't happen. And it was, like, already always a cope. And it's clearly not true. And there's all kinds of people that have deconstructed just the exhibits that are on display at the museum. But even that narrative, it can't hold together. It's not true, and it can't be true. And I think eventually they're going to have to abandon it, which is why they're going further and further east. The Holocaust always moves east. Remember this. Always is going to continue to move east, further to the east. Because that way they feel like, you know, people just know less and there's less evidence. Because those other camps, like, there's nothing left of them. All the other ones where supposedly 2.5 million Jews were killed, there's just nothing there. Except now there's a museum at Treblinka, but other than that, there was nothing. So they had to pretend to excavate it. Anyway, we're going to go. Let's head out, and we'll see you Wednesday when Sven's Power will be back.
Always give your best. Never discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember. Others may hate. Those who hate don't win unless you hate them.
and then destroy yourself.